Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Beto O'Rourke couldn't beat Ted Cruz in a Senate race, but could he go on to beat over a dozen Democrats in a primary and then Donald Trump in a general? We'll talk to Meet the Press's Chuck Todd about O'Rourke jumping in, the prison years that are piling up for Paul Manafort, and other political headlines. Then Medicare for All has become a punching bag for the GOP. At the same time, a growing number of Democrats are backing a Medicare for All bill, Congressman Joe Kennedy among them. We'll talk to him about that, his moral capitalism, as he calls it, and his support for Elizabeth Warren.
At noon, Andrew Cabral is here for another edition of Law and Order. Then we have a diplomacy roundtable with three former U.S. ambassadors. Rufus Gifford, Robert Barber, and Alan Solomon give us their take on the latest U.S.-North Korea summit and much more. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Marjorie Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
How's the anxiety level today doing?
It ebbs and flows, you know what I'm saying?
Joining us in the
line. Never quite calm.
To go over the latest political headlines to see if he can calm her down is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers here. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Hello, Chuck Todd.
Hey,
how are you?
Sorry, Marjorie. Why is the anxiety level high this week?
Because she's alive.
It's always. I'm one of those people that's been, you know, in a derangement syndrome for 2 years. Chuck, what can I tell you? What can I tell you?
Yeah, I hear you.
So Beto O'Rourke, the congressman who came close but didn't obviously unseat Ted Cruz down in Texas, is in already. He's getting criticized for everything he hasn't accomplished. What do you make of his arrival in the presidential race?
You know, is he Obama, Reagan? Is he Wesley Clark, John Edwards, Gary Hart, right? Like, I the point is we've seen here, right? There are these like sort of meteoric stars. They're kind of empty vessels sometimes that somehow capture the imagination of folks for, and the question is it a brief period or is it a longer period of that? You know, Reagan and Obama were able to successfully sell a platitudes in ways that inspired enough people to get to the presidency. Gary Hart never could fill in the blanks, right? Where's the beef? Where's the beef? And then, of course, it felt like when the scandals hit Gary Hart, same with John Edwards, you're like, this is what we get, attaching your, you know, assuming that some quick rising star is the answer. So the simple question is, I don't know the answer. And I think that that's what a presidential campaign is about. I think that Beto O'Rourke, I don't think there's a middle ground here. I think this is a boom or bust guy. You know, he's from Texas, so let's put it in wildcatting terms. He's either struck oil or it's a dry well. You know, he could be somebody that may not be stopped. Right? You may be able to ding him, but, you know, a la Obama. Obama never really was stopped. He had a few bumps in the road, but once he got in, it was nothing but really, you know, when you look at it from 30,000 feet. It was just an upward trajectory until Election Day.
Well, but
that could be better.
The good news for him.
But I don't know.
You know, we read in Slate this morning, Chuck Todd, that he's either for single payer, multiple payer, or otherwise. So I think that sort of covers all. You know, I can't decide either. Is this bad news for the 76 and 77-year-old Biden and Sanders? He's 46, O'Rourke. Or is it true that what we read was the Associated Press a couple of weeks ago suggesting that Biden and O'Rourke are already talked about teaming up as a president and vice president? How do you think it weighs on this whole they're too old to be president thing?
I think this is a real problem for Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. I think Sanders has more of a devoted following than Biden does. So Sanders campaign may survive longer than if this doesn't work for Biden. I have real skepticism here. I mean, this is an election that does feel like it is going to be generational in some form, right? That it's boomers versus the millennials trying to figure out who's in charge of our culture. The boomers and the millennials, those of us that aren't either, are sort of stuck having to pick sides, right? But that's what this feels like. And in some ways, Beto and Biden, right, even though Beto's not a millennial, he just wants to act like one. And Biden is your sort of proxy for the boomers, although he's technically not a baby boomer. Mm-hmm. He's the silent generation. He was born before right. the end of World War II,
that's right.
for what it's worth. Ditto with Sanders. I wonder, what does the Biden candidacy look like in 2 months? Right? It's going to look great on day one. It'll look fine in the first week. But, you know, when you're running as somebody over the age of 75, you can't have a bad health day. You can't have a day where you're just kind of run down. Because it's not that you're just kind of run down from having a long day that anybody, whether you're 20 or 75, would feel. Well, no. If he's feeling run down, it's like, uh-oh, is he up to the job? That's a type of pressure that I don't know if any candidate can handle, for what it's worth.
You know, I hadn't thought of this.
I have skepticism.
Does Barack Obama have to endorse Joe Biden on day one or close to day one?
No, I don't think so. He certainly has made it pretty clear. He never technically endorsed in the you know, he waited a long time to endorse in the 2016 primary, I think. He didn't really get behind Hillary until later in the process. So I think he's got some space there. I think that Obama I think it would be risky of Obama to endorse Biden early. Obviously, Biden needs it badly. But it's risky because if Biden doesn't win, then suddenly Obama's the perception of Obama's capital is suddenly lower. So I would imagine he won't. And that's the question is, does Obama ever distance himself from Biden? I think Biden is going to run on the Obama legacy. I think Biden is going to try to run with voters, assuming he's Obama's guy. And I wonder, the question I have, is there ever a moment where Biden hugs him too much and Obama has to push him away a little bit?
Talking to Chuck Todd.
You know, I will say one thing for the president of the United States, Donald Trump, for a guy who eats a lot of cheeseburgers and he's borderline obese. I mean, he does have an incredible amount of stamina. He's, what, 72?
72, I think.
Yeah, he was going like in the Energizer Bunny all during the last campaign. I know
he's preserving the battery. That's why.
Yeah.
Well, but you know what? It's funny you say that, Marjorie. No, he didn't.
He didn't?
He was brilliant. He did one event a day. He did one or maybe two events a day. That's actually not a very hard day. But he always flew. He was always tweeting. He was always – so the perception was, God, he was all over the place. He'd do a rally a day maybe, not even. And he never overnighted. He overnighted once in Iowa the entire time. He never did the door knocking. He never did any of that. Donald Trump was a part-time candidate. But he created the illusion – that he works hard. He creates the illusion. My God, he's an executive time till 11 o'clock. He works 4 or 5 hours a day. So, yes, it looks like he goes. I have to say, this is brilliant. I think it's an amazing feat that they've pulled off here.
Yeah, I know. He fooled me completely.
Apparently so.
But I really think everybody needs to realize, and in fact, Joe Biden needs to take a page from Trump. I think Biden ought to do one big event a day. And then you message like crazy all around it. Maybe you tweet. Maybe you do talk radio. Maybe you do, you know, phone interviews, whatever. You can create the perception you're everywhere, but only do one event a day. When you're over the age of 70, I think it's a smart way to go. I mean, they manage Trump's body clock very well to create the perception that he had a lot more energy than maybe he did.
So I was prefacing that. I was going to get to this other thing about Paul Manafort's sentencing. We've had two sentencings of Paul Manafort, the former campaign manager of the president. As we know, in the first one after Judge Ellis gave him 4 years, the lawyer for Manafort and the president declared that there was absolutely no collusion with Russia at the end of this trial. The trial wasn't about collusion with Russia. Then U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson kind of underscored, anticipating what the president might say, that her sentencing of Manafort yesterday, 3.5 years, I believe, had nothing to do with Russia once again. Yet the lawyer for Manafort once again comes out in front of the courthouse and says the two courts now have said there was absolutely no collusion, even though that wasn't true. And the president followed up on that yet again. So I guess this is another brilliant strategy, maybe, of fooling everybody with non-facts.
Well, you know, what it is it's actually, the problem is it's us, right? We know, oh, God, there goes the president saying something silly again. But we're airing the false narrative, right? And this is, you know, when you have a, when he is that shameless about saying things that aren't, well, that's exactly what didn't happen. But in the process of explaining that that is, in fact, what didn't happen, you still air his comment that says no collusion. I think it does have an impact over time. I think this propaganda that he spews out on the Russia story has had enough of an impact to essentially blunt whatever comes out in these reports.
Does he know? I think I asked you this 2 months ago, but let's do it again. When he said this yesterday, I am so incredulous. I know that's naive at this stage, that he's saying it with such certainty. Does he know that it's not true in your estimation?
He's not his psychiatrist.
That it couldn't be anywhere.
Oh, no. I mean, look, I'm working on this long research project. You can call it what you want to call it. I call it a research project for now. Basically, Trump through the years. And he's always operated this way. He learned this from Roy Cohn.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what the truth is. It matters what you get printed first. That was Roy Cohn's philosophy. It matters what you get printed first. You want the best example of how good and slimy these guys are when it comes to putting stuff? There's a great example. Elliot Spitzer and that whole Madam business.
Yes.
There was one weird detail that turned out to be not true at all.
Yeah.
Ankle Lake black socks.
Roger Stone.
Yes. Is that it, really?
Roger Stone just made it up.
Yes.
Not true. None of it was ever true. That part of it was never true. It was a detail so juicy you couldn't avoid it if you were, oh, my God, you know, because, you know, that's what you do. And the New York Post, it just was a willing, because the New York Post loves wood, right? Like, this is what they do, right? You know, salacious is their game. And Roger Stone, who learned at the master, Roy Cohn, and in that sense, you know, Roy Cohn was Walter Winchell's best, you know, Walter Winchell created this nonsense that we have, and Roy Cohn was among his best sources. This is who tutored Donald Trump. And what you do, you just say whatever it takes, be the first one to say it, and say it more often than anybody else, period.
And, you know, I was stunned. I watched that Roger Stone documentary, Get Me Roger Stone, mm-hmm. and that's when I first learned, Chuck Todd, that Roger Stone just, he said, I knew this would be an irresistible detail. And my goodness, how many times have I repeated that with the black socks?
We did whole shows on it, Marjorie, on our
I mean, who hasn't worn black socks when they're out with a lady of the evening, Chuck Todd, right? You know, I mean, but it's true.
I mean, and it's like, it is, when you try to, In fact, it is emblematic of trying to truly understand Trump. They lie constantly because it doesn't matter what the truth is. It matters what they look like at the end of it. Are they still standing at the end of it? You know, Michael Cohen in his testimony essentially laid out, said the Trump Organization was, you know, was basically everybody was out for themselves. And that's ultimately how it always is. So the truth just gets in the way of wherever you need to, you know, it's just a hurdle. It's just a hurdle that gets in the way. So you're goddamn right he knows exactly what he's doing, because it's all about, you know, it's all about raising doubts. You know, whether there was collusion or not, Trump knows if people believe there was collusion, he's dead in the water. And if people don't believe there's collusion, he can survive. So it doesn't matter what the truth is to him. It matters what people will believe.
We're talking to Chuck Todd. Chuck, we want to get in a second to something we're obsessed with, and it relates to your conversation with Arne Duncan. But before that, very quickly, it appears that with the addition of former Massachusetts governor, now Utah Senator Mitt Romney, there's six Republicans who are going to vote with the Democrats in the Senate to reject the emergency declaration. Obviously, the president will veto it in their votes. What's the significance of enough Republicans to join Democrats to at least do what they're doing, even if at the end of the day, Trump is going to carry the day? Does it matter?
Oh, here's how I think it matters. I mean, I'm curious of what the number will get to. You know why it would matter? What if it got to 20?
Well, obviously it would matter.
If it got to 20, then that you'd say to yourself, that's 67. What would you need 67 votes in the Senate to do? what's the Constitution say about 67 votes under a certain? The point is, I think, put it this way. If you aren't willing to stand up to Trump on this, then you're obviously never willing to potentially deal with the ultimate vote you may have to cast when it comes to the future of the Trump presidency. So in that sense, that is how I'm watching it, because I believe, aside from Rand Paul and Mike Lee, who are probably, you know, as principled on this as any two people when it comes to these kind of constitutional questions, I think they both acquit the president. I think they wouldn't do that. But take those two away. Every other person that ends up voting against the president on this, I think you would look at them, and they are the profile of the type of senator that might be open-minded on an impeachment trial, right? So in that sense, that's what you're trying to find out. How big is the potential Republican resistance? And this vote, I think it's kind of a free vote now. Now that the president has said, I'm going to veto it, and you know there's not a veto proof. So I think anybody that's on the fence now, and there appear to be another four or five, I assume it'll get up to 10 or 11 votes,
really?
Republican votes, which tells you why Nancy Pelosi said, we're not going to do impeachment. You know, until she sees – she's a vote counter. Until she sees the numbers, she ain't going to pursue this. And then if you can't get 20 for this, which is an easy violation of the Constitution between Article 1 and Article 2, then you're not going to get them for anything else.
We're talking with Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. Jim just mentioned that you had Arne Duncan on MTP Daily. He used to be, of course, the education czar for Barack Obama, talking about this college bribery scam where celebrities, powerful businessmen, wealthy people paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to get their unqualified or underqualified kids into schools like Yale and Stanford and Georgetown. I think you said when you were talking to Arne Duncan that, you know, this had just lifted the rock on it was the tip of the iceberg of the corruption of higher education. So elaborate on that.
Look, think about the way the entire funding structure works in higher ed. Take away tuition and take away whatever's taxpayer funds are used. So take away those two things. Everything else in a university is essentially funded by donations. And the minute you're funded by donations, and the minute for many universities is now a majority of the funding, right, is not through tuition nor state funding. It is through some form of donations, right, endowment, whatever you want to call it. Well, that means you rationalize, you cut corners, you're willing to take money from people that you wouldn't normally do business with. I mean, look, I saw Donna Shalala, who I think is a very upstanding person, okay? I do not think anything terrible about her as an individual. She was president of the University of Miami, and there's this horrible picture now. It's a horrible picture of her next to this donor to the University of Miami and gave some astronomical number to the athletic department. It turned out this guy was like paying players and all this stuff. And the thing is that if you spent 5 minutes doing a background check on this guy, you'd realize, I ain't taking his money. This is crazy. But universities are so starved for the resources. They have done things that, you know, I kind of find the whole dorm, the way they remodel dorms and the amount of money they spend on that.
Oh, my God.
You know, all the stuff that is not towards education, all that wasted money. Anyway, my point is that I think it's not corrupt, but it's easily corruptible. It's too corruptible, that system. It's like our system of politics. When the whole thing is on donations, and at some point when you're relying on other people's money, you start rationalizing. You want to find a way to take that money because you need that money. And it's a slippery slope. So I think over time, universities just, you know, as the budgets got bigger and all this stuff. Look, I feel like universities haven't been held accountable for the financial crisis. I believe they are directly responsible for the amount of extra debt people had to take on the first time to send their kids to college and your second mortgages and all this nonsense. Right between about 95, I think I went to GW in 1990 and it was less than 10 grand a year. And now it's over 70. Okay.
Wow.
Something went haywire somewhere in the mid-90s, and they're not alone. Somewhere in the mid-90s to about 05, something went haywire. And they have never been held responsible for them taking advantage of the fact that there was cheap credit out there. I had plenty of cousins and family members who took second mortgages out to pay tuition right? Which, of course, helped contribute to the financial crisis. And now what's happened? Now they're contributing to the financial crisis another way. Now they've loaded up a whole generation of students with astronomical student debt that is the equivalent of a mortgage payment that these millennials can't afford to buy a house yet because they're already paying a mortgage and a rent because the equivalent of it due to their student debt. So now universities are going to be basic. This is actually going to create another crisis in the housing market in about 10 years, by the way, especially in the used housing market, because they've saddled everybody with what was supposedly cheap credit. And they figured, oh, you know, they can get it. They can approve it. And they've created this, you know, this horrendous system. So, look, I think that the entire system, it's a systemic problem. And the entire way universities are funded needs to be looked at.
So much for Chuck Todd making Marjorie less anxious than she was.
I know. But it really,
nice.
I'll say this.
What?
Isn't this emblematic? You know what? This story, guys, is actually emblematic of the larger fight we're having in America between the haves and the have-nots,
yep.
Urban and rural.
Absolutely.
You know, Donald Trump, what did Donald Trump win by? He won by saying, hey, this system's rigged against you guys. Guess what? I know how to play I know how to win the rig system. I'll win it for you. I know how to rig it too, right? This is why they went with him, because the system is rigged. They're not wrong, right? Bernie Sanders and Trump were right in their messaging. It's rigged. They just had different ways. You know, Sanders wants to reform the entire system, and Trump is saying, it's too late to reform it. I'll navigate it. But
yeah.
Either way, it's the same message they're sending and responding to, which is a system that feels like, if you have enough money, you can network and pay your way out of anything. And if you don't, you're holding the bag, sucker.
That's where we are, 2019,
yeah.
United States of America. But we all know that Jared Kushner, paid $2.6 million to get him into Harvard. So
hey,
it
I guess
some...
that's the back door.
It's unrelated. Chuck, great to talk to you.
As someone said, the reason why didn't they just donate that way? Buildings don't cost $1 million anymore. They cost $300 million.
Exactly.
Talk to you next week,
Thank
Chuck.
You
Thanks.
Very much.
Bye.
Bye. Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC, Channel 37 on most providers, and he's the political director for NBC News. Coming up, Congressman Joe Kennedy joins us to talk Medicare for All, his early support for Elizabeth Warren over his Texas road trip buddy, Beto O'Rourke. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In a recent piece for the American Prospect, Congressman Joe Kennedy argues there's an alternative to Trumpism. It's not impeaching the president. It's not the Mueller investigation. It's not becoming an expatriate. It's moral capitalism. To generalize, that means creating an economy that will offset the injustices perpetuated by our current system. He joins us online to elaborate on this, his support for Elizabeth Warren, and a whole host of other things. Congressman Kennedy, great to talk to you.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us, Congressman. So let's start with this moral capitalism and your support for Elizabeth Warren. Is she representative of moral capitalism?
I think she is. And I think she's, by a large margin, has been devoted her life, her career, her time in the Senate and before to actually addressing the structural inequities we see in our economy. Obviously, that's probably most well known for the work that she did in bankruptcy before becoming a professor, and that work informed an awful lot by looking at our healthcare system and looking at the high rate of bankruptcy because of inadequate healthcare protections and medical bankruptcies and the proliferation of medical bankruptcies. And so, look, my own take on this was driven from traveling around the country an awful lot over the course of the past year in preparation for these midterm elections and helping some of my colleagues, and the recognition that while President Trump would celebrate our lower unemployment rates and higher stock market prices, that there are an awful lot of people out there that are feel like they are barely getting by. And we saw this even a couple of years before at the end of an Obama administration where it was difficult to actually tout the economic success that President Obama had helped to achieve, because when you went to certain parts of the country, certain parts of Massachusetts, my own district, people said, hey, that is not the lived reality or experience that I can share. And I think the Democratic narrative on this has largely been, you work hard, you play by the rules, you should be able to get ahead. Well, a lot of folks are working hard and playing by the rules, and they're not getting ahead. And the critique, although I don't know if it's wholly accurate, and I don't think it is wholly accurate, of the part of the solution here has been, well, we can redistribute our way out of this. And redistribution is a critically important piece to this. Tax rates need to go up. The wealthy need to pay their fair share, no doubt, and that's a place to start. But that doesn't get to the worker empowerment part. And look, our economy, the most powerful economy in the world, it is not too much to ask that we have a structure set up that allows everyday middle-class and working-class families be able to actually provide for their own, for themselves, for their families, and for a brighter future. And redistribution, there we go.
Fine. Whatever it is, we know alone, what you're talking about.
Exactly right. Redistribution alone does not solve for that problem. And that's where it's everything from, and give a big shout out to our Attorney General Maura Healey for the non-competes and no poach clauses that she just struck a resolution with yesterday with some of our fast food chains. That the idea that folks that are working in fast food restaurants have to sign contracts that say that they can't go take another job if they get a 50 cent or dollar raise down the street. The idea that there's bars against class action lawsuits and that are coming down from the Supreme Court and forced arbitration clauses, the use of the issues around antitrust law to look at the massive consolidation we are seeing in our across various industries in our country, from aviation and airline companies to healthcare to insurance companies, which antitrust law looks at this at the moment in terms of the impact on prices. It doesn't look at it about the impact on labor and how if there's only three or four insurance companies or three or four airline companies, if you can't go get a job elsewhere because there's not sufficient competition for that labor market, then wages are going to get depressed.
You know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So there's a whole lot of other pieces to this that I think deserve our attention, that are critically important to putting workers and families back at the center of our economy, rather than just saying, hey, pointing to the stock market and saying, hey, because that's going up, things are going great. Well, 50% of Americans don't own a single stock, so that is not an adequate reflection. And unemployment rates being low, of course, that's a good thing. But if an unemployment rate being low still means that people have to be on food stamps to feed their family because corporations can pay such low wages that you can't feed your family, then that's also not an adequate reflection of the health of our economy.
So, as Marjorie said, Joe Kennedy, not only are you a supporter of Elizabeth Warren, you introduced her at her kickoff thing. I want to play a little sound from a local guy who did some campaigning around the country. He was campaigning for some guy in Texas, and then he did a Facebook Live thing. And here's part of what he had to say.
Everybody asks me all the time, who's going to be the next president of the United States? And I, obviously at this point, it's early to tell. I've got a couple dark horse candidates. Beto leads that pack, because after he becomes a senator from the great state of Texas, look, for a Democrat at the moment to be able to win statewide in Texas, I actually think is more difficult than to run for president. So, Beto, I am all in. Ambassador to Ireland sounds great.
So he didn't make it to the Senate, but as you know, your good buddy announced, and former congressman announced, for the presidency today. Did you not know this was coming and thus decided Warren was your person? Or did you decide Warren was the best person, even if your buddy O'Rourke decided to get in the race?
So, Jim, as you know from being around, and Marjorie as well, from being around this this business, you have you develop friendships, and Beto, Congressman O'Rourke, is a good friend. He's going to remain a good friend, and he still is a good friend. He's one of my closest friends when we served together in Congress. I still keep in touch with him pretty frequently. And I was in touch with him over the course of the past several months as he was kind of going through the decision-making process. And I think he really dedicated himself to try to figure out what was best for him and his family. And I have no doubt his campaign will make a tremendous contribution to the discourse and the discussion and the debate that we need to have as a Democratic Party and as a country. I go back an awful long way with our senior senator. She was my professor in law school.
We know that.
I think I think that she, when it comes to as the issues that I just laid out around the structural inadequacies in our economy, and I think that that is the most critical issue out there, because it is those inadequacies that you see rearing their heads in this debate on healthcare, in the debate on immigration, and the debate on, to a very real extent, a debate on climate change. It's the ways in which our economy is not actually representing the and answering the needs of an electorate that are causing these inequities. I don't think that there's anybody out there in this race that has done as much or is going to be as powerful a spokesperson than Senator Warren. I also, you know, look, I'm in an odd position where of the class that I came in with in Congress back in sworn in 2013, there looks to be four or five of my classmates that are going to be running for the presidency, folks that I know very well, and a couple other members of the House that might be running. I've got friends in the Senate that are considering these races as well. So it's an odd circumstance where you actually have to sit around and say, yeah, I got a bunch of buddies that are running for president. But, you know, such is life these days. And with like two dozen people in, if either of you want to announce, now's a great time to do it.
Well, we were going to say that to you, actually.
You should mention that, Congressman, because I think Jim has from time to time, you know, wondered exactly why.
I don't want to give up the show. I mean, that's about it. So, Joe Kennedy, before we leave Elizabeth Warren, do you support her wealth tax, which I haven't, might apply to you? Do you support it?
Yeah, I do. Okay. Look, I think the given the level of inequity we have in our country, it is not unreasonable to ask people that have done very well to make sure that we are allowing them to continue to succeed and to leverage that success and to continue to grow that success, but that we take some part of that to reinvest back in to our system to ensure that economic mobility remains the bedrock of the American dream. And you know, the numbers there can change, I think, a little bit. But I think the purpose of what Senator Warren, that proposal was, is to say, look, for the folks that have done extremely well across our society, asking them to chip in a bit more to make sure that economic mobility remains a bedrock of our society and of our foundation, of our country, I don't think is unreasonable.
We're talking to Congressman Joe Kennedy.
Congressman, as you know, Nancy Pelosi has sort of thrown ice water on the enthusiasm of some members of the Democrat members of Congress regarding impeachment. She says she's not interested in that right now. The president's not worth it. There seems to be a divide among the Democrats. Where are you on impeaching the president?
I don't think – I think Speaker Pelosi is right. I think at this point, given what is publicly available and given the information that I have seen, that is all of what has been publicly available, given the information that we know now, that impeachment would be an extremely divisive issue through the House of Representatives and I think dead on arrival in the Senate. I think the president has given us plenty to run on to try to make the case to the American public as to why he does not deserve another term. And I expect that it's part of the reason why you've seen such a robust and talented group of challengers jump on into a presidential to a Democratic nomination, because so many believe that there's an alternative story to tell for this country. Now, to you both, I just to be very clear, it is entirely plausible that over the course of the next several weeks, if Mr. Mueller is actually wrapping that up, his investigation up, that as documents get shared with Congress, and I wholeheartedly support a full disclosure of information of that report to Congress and the American public, because this is not just a question of whether crimes were in fact committed, but as to what happened so that the American public can have faith in the integrity of our electoral process, and that happens by disclosure and transparency. That information is shared, and if it comes clear that crimes were committed or there was various activity that is not reflective of the stature of the presidency, then that obviously may very well change. And it is why, again, the American public and Congress need to get that full report from Robert Mueller, and the investigations that we have now launched in the House of Representatives need to also see their way through, because Mr. Mueller's inquiry is around crimes that were or were not committed. But that is very different. That is a different standard than I think the American public necessarily shares about impeachment. And we need to have a full accounting for what exactly happened. And unfortunately, our Republican colleagues, when they were in control of the investigations, clearly that was not their priority.
Congressman, I think you may be hoping for something that millions of Americans and many of your colleagues are not. You told Van Jones on CNN in an interview that you hope the Mueller report turns up nothing for the sake of our democracy. What do you mean by that?
Marjorie, I think we all share that hope. I hope that, I mean, I can't imagine you or anybody else is rooting for a scenario where either the president of the United States or a Republican nominee or members of his senior members of his staff engaged with an adversary in Russia or individuals tied to Russian intelligence that actually influenced our election.
I think that's a horrible thing. I think some people are rooting for that.
Anybody's rooting for that.
Marjorie is Congressman, but
I didn't say me.
Anybody wants that to have happened. I don't think you want that to have happened. If it did happen, obviously, those folks need to be held accountable to the highest extent of the law. But if it's a question that people are asking as to whether you hope that somebody interfered or foreign adversary interfered with our election and it was able to sway the results of that election, of course I hope that did not happen. If it did, then our process better be able to actually hold those individuals accountable. That's what I was referring to.
We're talking to
I don't think, Marjorie, you're hoping that Russia did interfere with our election, right?
Well,
Russia did interfere.
They did.
I don't think that's in dispute.
Yeah, I believe our intelligence agencies that Russia did interfere with our election.
Russia did, but at the direction of or with the cooperation of President Trump and or his senior campaign team. I think that's that is the point that I was getting at. Just
okay.
Trying to make sure that they did not. That and a hope that that part and those concerns are going to be proved to be invalid. Now, I hope that's true. I'm not so sure that's true. And again, in which case, they need to be held accountable to the highest extent of the law.
One last very quick thing on this, Congressman Kennedy. A lot of your colleagues think that even if Bob Mueller issued a clean bill of health for the President of the United States, that it has already been proven that he has committed a variety of impeachable offenses. Are you among those people?
I'm not sure if it's been proven yet, and I would argue that I'm not sure who's proven that, Jim. I think, do I have concerns that he's committed impeachable offenses? Yeah, I do have concern that he's committed impeachable offenses. Do we need to have more, I think, evidence of that come to light? Yeah, we absolutely do. But let's be clear, I've got concerns around the emoluments issues, which are the improper enrichment of himself or companies that he has refused to actually divest himself of. Yeah, I've got real concerns on that. Let's be clear, the court cases challenging that are in the process of doing so, the remedy that they are seeking is that divestment. It's that the president is willing to sell, if found that it is a violation of the Constitution, it's that he sell his shares. And if he doesn't, then the remedy potentially is impeachment. But it doesn't mean that if found to be improper, that it's necessarily that he's impeached right away. That's not the remedy that those lawsuits are seeking. If it is around obstruction of justice, obviously that's evidence of a crime. And I've got grave concerns around it, about what was publicly available. I was a prosecutor. I've tried cases on less evidence than what was publicly available. Robert Mueller knows a lot more about this than I do. I am certain of that. And so that's where I think it is important that we wait for that report to come back so that we can get an understanding as to what he knows, what evidence they've got, and what can be demonstrated. And I don't want to jump the gun on this because I recognize how serious a debate and discussion this is. And the potential consequences for our country.
We're talking to Congressman Joe Kennedy. Congressman, you have co-sponsored a Medicare for All bill. Tell us why, and what about concerns about cost?
So a lot in there, Marjorie. So why gets back to a pretty basic concern is that I believe that in this country, healthcare is a right, and that every single person deserves access to the healthcare that they need when they need it at a price that they can afford. And what we have seen now for an awfully long time is that trying to build a private infrastructure out on top of a public good and a human right has been exceedingly difficult. This is more than just coverage. Massachusetts, we have essentially universal coverage. We've got basically 98% of our population here covered with health care. Access and quality are the next components to that, and that are two things that we are still striving for in Massachusetts. But I got to be honest with you, one of the things that really helped me kind of decide that it is time for a change was reading a speech that my uncle gave in 1971 when he introduced a single-payer bill on the floor of the United States Senate. And he pointed to some of the disparities in our healthcare system, issues around maternal mortality, around mental health, I believe, as well. And 50 years of good people in government, outside of government, private sector, public sector, trying to make sure that we expand access to our healthcare system. 50 years later, an African-American woman is 243% more likely to die during childbirth than a white woman. 50 years later, we still have an episode reported in the Boston Globe a little while ago of an African-American woman that slipped and fell in Mission Hill and broke her wrist and didn't even think of going to a private hospital down the street with one of the best orthopedic surgical practices anywhere in the world, but instead hopped in a cab and went across town to Boston Medical Center. 50 years later, we still have these enormous inequities around access to care and adequacy of care that our system has not been able to address. And so my co-sponsorship of this bill, is not without questions, and when I put out the statement supporting it, there's major questions that are still left around adequacy of networks, around reimbursement for doctors so they know how much they're going to get compensated, around mental and behavioral health, around a tax burden, around who pays for it. And the who pays part is an issue we have to address, but let's also be clear that most of us, you and I probably, I certainly, pay a monthly fee already to our – there's a fee deducted out of my paycheck that goes to my insurance company. So when you hit there – or when you hear people say, well, it's a $30 trillion increase in taxes, well, that's going to be offset by the money that you are currently paying in premiums and deductibles. So that is not nearly reflective of the overall cost of the bill from an actual consumer's perspective. That might be the government side of it, but that's not to say you're paying that much more. And the government already spends about, of the $3 trillion a year we spend in healthcare, government is already responsible for about $2 trillion of that $3 trillion. So there's some aspects here that need to get fleshed out, yes, and big questions that we need to answer, yes. But we can't just continue to sit there and say for marginalized populations, for populations that our healthcare industry and our healthcare sector is not seeing, the concerns that they are not taking into consideration, the voices they are not hearing. I don't think we can continue to say, hey, wait another 50 years and we'll try to make sure that the chance of you die while giving birth will hopefully get better over that time because we're going to keep on trying. That 50 years is long enough to wait.
We're talking with Congressman Joe Kennedy. Congressman, you represent Fall River, where a very odd thing happened this week. Jason Carrera is a 27-year-old mayor of the city. He's facing federal tax evasion and fraud charges. He was recalled by 60% of the population in Fall River, of the voters in Fall River, I should say, in a recall election. But then in the same time, he was reelected, even though 60% of the people that voted picked one of his challengers, but he got the most votes. What do you make of this rather bizarre situation?
It's a rather bizarre situation, Marjorie. I think you said it well. So, yes, you got the numbers obviously right. About 60% of the voters in Fall River believe that the mayor should be recalled. 60% of them voted for other candidates, yet the mayor came out on top. And obviously I will respect the will of the voters in Fall River. They selected the mayor to continue out his term, and I acknowledge that and accept it. I do think regardless, it is going to be difficult for a mayor to be able to carry out the full responsibilities that the people of Fall River deserve and that the city is going to need while facing over 10 counts of a federal indictment. And so I respect the will of the voters. I do think that Fall River deserves some stability and somebody that can devote their full attention. And I can only imagine how much attention somebody can give to the job of serving the public when they're under multiple counts of a federal indictment.
So are you suggesting in there that he should step down, or you're suggesting the voters made a decision and should be respected?
I think I'm suggesting both.
Okay. Okay. Hey, before you go, Congressman, obviously everybody in America has been hearing the story about Andrew Lelling's announcement about this college admissions scam. We know you went to Stanford, and we know your roommate went on to be an NBA.
I did not play water polo.
Well, wait a second. There are rumors that your parents said you should be a small forward on the Stanford. Is there any?
On the basketball team.
Is there any truth to me being a small forward?
Yes.
Jim, there, you might have seen the press reports early on in my time at Stanford. There was some guy, some kid wandering around a pool with a horse, wondering how I got the horse out of the pool. I don't know. May or may not have been me.
Okay.
Congressman, we really appreciate your time.
Yeah. Appreciate it, guys. Thanks,
Joe.
Thank
Kennedy.
You very much. That was honestly graduated from Stanford, Congressman Joe Kennedy III. He's a member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee.
Can I say one thing about him? We didn't have time to ask, and we try not to take positions. He's got to be celebrated for leading the charge.
Oh, transgender. We didn't get to transgender.
No, we didn't have time for this absurd, sadistic policy of the Trump administration on transgender members of the military, and so we didn't have time to broach it. But congratulations to Joe Kennedy for leading that charge.
Okay, and Congressman Kennedy, thank you very much for joining us.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Marjorie, you wanted to say something about the tea? What was that?
I just got an email from Robert who said he wanted to pass this along, that he's been sitting on the Red Line train somewhere underneath Harvard Square. It's been 55 minutes so far. This is a while ago, so I don't know if he's still there or not. 55 minutes so far to get from Davis to this point beneath Harvard Square. Gotta love Massachusetts.
Well, tell him he's got to work on his math, because the spokesperson for the T in the Globe says it's only a 15-minute delay. So obviously, but there is good news to
That's
Robert.
Good news.
The T is in the process, according to the Globe and Joe Pastore, their spokesperson, of manufacturing a replacement section of rail. So I would suggest.
So maybe in a couple of weeks they'll be manufactured, that section of rail.
I think by the 2020 elections, he's in good shape.
I'm sorry, Robert, you could be there for a couple of months.
You know, original intention here was to talk to you about the Beto O'Rourke candidacy, but obviously time is really short. But here's just a little tiny piece of what he had to say in this announcement video this morning.
Amy and I are happy to share with you that I'm running to serve you as the next president of the United States of America.
And, you know, again, apologies, we don't have time to take calls, just a brief discussion here. It sounded to me, I don't know what your interpretation was, Chuck Collins, he's 46 years old, Beto O'Rourke, and if you watch him, we were watching on CNN this morning before the show, mm-hmm. he was at some, I don't know, coffee shop, bar or something, luncheonette or something in Iowa immediately after his announcement went out. And he's really full life, a lot of gesticulation.
Yeah.
He's
got
young,
a large wingspan.
46 kind of thing. Did Chuck not indicate, I think he said, I don't want to put words in his mouth, he thought that does create a problem for the two frontrunners who are 76 and 77 years old, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, respectively. And I tend to think
that he's right. I don't know. I mean, there's already criticism coming out about Beto O'Rourke. He's very enthusiastic about ideas, but can't make up his mind which idea he supports, and he doesn't really have an ideology. And you don't know whether part of the fact of his sensation down in Texas, where he came close to beating Ted Cruz, was that Ted Cruz is probably the most disliked man in the entire Congress. I mean, you listen to all these Congress people joke about how nobody can stand him, and Juliette Kyem said nobody can stand him back when he was at Harvard University a million years ago.
Trump's a pretty polarizing character, too, you know.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people are charmed by Donald Trump. Mm. I think Donald Trump is able to turn on the charm.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true of Ted Cruz. So we don't know if this was just because he was running against Ted Cruz or if there's something more here. We'll see.
But it does. I mean, I know you, well, not you, but people get aggravated me constantly talking about the age of the two front runners. Mm-hmm. And it may be a non-issue. And as Sanders supporters have said, it was surely a non-issue with young voters in Sanders' race in 2016. Clearly, young voters were most excited by the oldest candidate in the race.
Well,
I think even
at
that time.
They don't know how tired you are by 75.
He would have been the oldest president had he been elected at mm-hmm. the time of his election. Donald Trump was when he was elected a couple of years ago, but I think it does raise an issue. And, you know, by the way, while there's one problem is what's his position? I was literally quoting. I was not making that up when he said on healthcare, he's either for a single-payer system, a dual-payer system, or otherwise was his quote in Slate. The lack of accomplishment, and I couldn't find a major legislative accomplishment. What was Barack Obama's major legislative accomplishment in the United States Senate?
What's Elizabeth Warren's major legislative
accomplishment?
Well,
the hearing aid thing is actually a huge thing.
It is,
thing.
But I don't
thing.
Think people would say that was a massive accomplishment.
Applies
I mean, I think
a lot of people.
I think a lot of people run for offices who haven't been able to get anything through this Congress. I don't think it's necessarily a blot against them because the Congresses for the last couple of years haven't been able to get much of anything
done. Let me say in Warren's defense, I think it's true that she has changed the debate on a lot of issues.
She's totally changed the debate.
What issue has Beto O'Rourke changed the debate on when he was a member of the House of Representatives?
As far as I know, he's not changed the debate on anything. I didn't mean to downplay.
I'm not disparaging her or him or her.
She, as I've said a million times, she's a true believer. You know exactly where she's coming from. She's been coming from the same place for 25 years. The Consumer Bureau is largely her creation, even though she didn't get to run it. I don't know about him. I mean, he's untried. We'll just have to see what happens. What do you think?
If I read Chuck correctly, I think he's not just 46 chronologically. Mm-hmm. He is an explosively full of youth kind of candidate.
Right.
And I think there is going to – I think it's going to paint a contrast. We talked yesterday
about why the reason
well, people can't see you, nor do they see him, so it's hard to –
It's a wingspan.
The fact that Trump's in his 70s sort of mutes the issue of how old the leading Democrats are, but the issue isn't muted when an exciting young candidate, and again, I have no idea if he's going to be a flash in the pan or not, is 46 years old. So it's an interesting candidacy. I thought because O'Rourke and Kennedy were so close that when Kennedy, that's what I was trying to get at with the congressman, when Kennedy announced on day one that he was supporting Elizabeth Warren, I read into that incorrectly that his buddy Beto O'Rourke had told him he wasn't running for the presidency. But obviously, that was incorrect.
Coming up, Andrea Cabral is with us with another edition of Law and Order. She's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, ineffective, irreversible, and immoral. That's how Governor Gavin Newsom described the death penalty when he signed an executive order yesterday to suspend it. Now 737 inmates in California get a stay of execution. At noon, we'll talk to former Secretary of Public Safety Andrea Cabral about this, our state's highest court's decision to reinstate Aaron Hernandez's murder conviction, and more on today's edition of Law and Order.
In today's era of hyperpolarization around the world, how crucial is diplomacy and what role should it play when our current administration is promoting America First? We'll find out when three former ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors, Rufus Gifford, Robert Barber, and Alan Solomon join us. Then WGBH science correspondent Heather Goldstone joins us to talk about the Me Too reckoning among women in science and how white people are responsible for most of our air pollution. All that is next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. Here with us in Studio 3 for another edition of Law and Order is Andrea Cabral. Andrea is the former Secretary of Public Safety for the Commonwealth, former Suffolk County Sheriff, and the current CEO of Ascend. Hello there, Andrea Cabral.
Hello. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks.
So, Andrea Cabral, later in the show, we're going to talk about again about this college bribery scam with the well-to-do paying all this money to get kids that would not otherwise get into these fancy-dancy colleges. Great piece in the Washington Post by a Latina woman who talked about how she spent much of her career at Stanford having to defend the fact that she got there not because she was any old Latina kid who just everyone was feeling sorry for and we need to change our, get our diversity numbers up and stuff, but because she had almost a perfect GPA and huge scores in her SATs. The point is, I'm sure you've encountered this as being first black woman sheriff or first in your college life or something, having this idea that, you know, every person who's black or brown should be grateful they're there because they don't really deserve to be there.
Well, Marjorie, what I'll say is that I am, you know, so obviously qualified and so obviously intelligent
of course.
That that has probably not been as much of a problem for me as it has for other people. I think practically every person of color has encountered this based on the presumptions of a white person or a group of white people. Two things. One, that being white and qualified is the default position. That's the premise that is fallacious here. The premise is that it's like when you hear people talk about identity politics as though the centuries-old running an election of white candidates, particularly white male candidates, is not identity politics. Of course it's identity politics, but if you embrace the view that is what should be, because that's the default position, to be white male and entitled to things, then it looks as though everyone else is getting something special. So it's the underlying lie that is the problem. And I think that's some of what Vargas speaks to in her article. And so, yes, people of all different other groups experience this assumption or a certain level of disdain for them, their achievements in the exact same arena as counterparts that are less intelligent, less qualified, have worse grades. I'm glad that we're speaking to the lie now. We're identifying the underlying lie.
I think you both are being too genteel about, I think what Vargas is basically saying is shut up, you know, instead of doing what you've done forever, questioning any person of color who ends up in an elite spot or an elite school. How about looking at the people to your left or right who are white, who didn't earn that spot, and let's talk about them for the next century instead? I mean, her
piece is
really killer.
Well, that's why I said what
killer.
I said at the very beginning, which was, and I, you know, it was said a bit tongue in cheek, but yeah, that was essentially what I was saying as well. But that's not going to happen because the demagoguing. It's really interesting how we look at the current demagoguing and the historical demagoguing of immigrants for any one of a number of social and domestic ills. It's you know, sort of time honored throughout history. But this is also demagoguing. The demagoguing of, students of color, of people of color, LGBT people, the whole notion of special rights, which are essentially the same rights as any white person, particularly any white male person, would enjoy in this country. But when a different group asks for it, that's a special right. This has all been demagoguing, the demagoguing of people who work and are entitled to a position in higher education or in some profession as though they are somehow gaming the system or taking something to which they are not entitled. That's why I keep saying the underlying lie is that the default position of being particularly white and male and presumptively qualified, that's the real problem. And I agree with you. I think Vargas is saying right out, just shut up about it. I wish people would shut up about it. I doubt that people will shut up. I think this will it'll continue to go on.
I don't know if you're listening when Chuck Todd called in. His head almost exploded. No, I mean, while we're talking about issues of race, he talks about how systemic this is. I am not a silver lining kind of person almost ever about anything. However, U.S. Attorney Lelling did his press conference, a lot of really important issues have been raised. Not only this Vargas issue, but issues of... There's legal versions of the exact same purchasing of seats. Obviously, we've talked about the Kushner thing nonstop here. My hope is that our attention span in this country, which is usually that of a gnat, lasts a little bit longer. And some of these discussions about the inequities in the whole higher education admission system actually continue for a while. So maybe we can help.
Not just legal ways, but policy ways. Legacies are that.
Of course.
So the entire time people have been screaming about affirmative action, kids have been getting into colleges solely because their parents went and their parents before them and their parents before them. And if that isn't a solidification of a particular white infrastructure in higher education, I don't know what else is.
Yeah.
We're talking to Andrew. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, maybe naively, that I do think that this is so shocking that people were paying this kind of money that I think it will make you look twice at the really rich kids sitting next to you too, I think, but maybe that's wrong.
I don't know.
Can I read you one thing to lighten this up? We were going to read this. We love Andy Borowitz, as Marjorie, all our listeners know. Andy Borowitz just released this thing about 11 o'clock this morning. Headline is, Betsy DeVos suggests that bribing colleges helps students learn math. And the one example, we'll read more a little later because we're going to take your calls on this at 1:30. Okay, let's say Jenna has a 470 verbal score, but she needs 730 to get into Yale, DeVos said. How much will she have to pay to get her score changed? Which I think
he's,
is just...
He's not that far off from some of her actual positions. He's fantastic.
Yeah. So the SJC, I think unanimously, am I not right about this, says that the law that I think has been in place for decades and decades, it says if you're convicted 75. Of a crime but you die during the pendency of an appeal,
6-0.
Your underlying conviction is vitiated, the right word? Is done away with? Obviously, this was key in the conviction over the murder of Odin Lloyd in the case of Aaron Hernandez. And 7-0, they say, no, there's no basis for this. The conviction stands. There'll be a statement that's saying when he died or there was a appeal pending. Did they make the right decision?
I think they did, but it's an interesting and actually more complicated issue than I think it appears on its face. I did not, I should confess, have time to read the entire 36-page decision. But I think the notion that it involves notions of finality of judgment, right? So it is absolutely true that people are found guilty at trial and they immediately begin to serve their punishment regardless of their appeal and the eventual decisions on that appeal. I think the presumption of innocence is overcome by a guilty verdict, and then you are then looking for errors of law. And sometimes, depending on, errors of fact, but generally errors of law, to reverse that conviction. And it might result in a new trial or not. But the idea that your conviction, that all of those findings, that a jury's findings of fact, that a judge's findings of law at the trial level, as Jim say, are vitiated if you die or you commit suicide, and I think that had something to do with it, is that you are for whatever the reasons, you are affirmatively choosing to take your life, so you die an innocent person, I think struck them as just inherently unfair and wrong. But I think there is something to the idea that until the court of final judgment speaks via an appeal, because many convictions are overturned and people ultimately are vindicated. I think that's what the original decision was based on. I happen to agree with the SJC that notion is antiquated. And that the presumption of innocence doesn't carry beyond the initial conviction. You're then just looking for specific types of errors that might result in a new trial where you could ultimately be vindicated. But I've always thought it was sort of wrong to say that if a defendant died while an appeal was pending, it's as though nothing ever happened in the lower court.
And for whatever it's worth, and I have no idea if this is real or not, I think it was a lawyer or a spokesperson for Odin Lloyd's family saying how much this meant to them. I hate the term closure, but the lawyer used it, provided some closure for them, and I hope that is, in fact, true.
So out in California, according to these stories I've read about the death penalty with Gavin Newsom, the governor there, there are 737 inmates on death row. But the governor has announced a moratorium on capital punishment, and this will grant these 737 inmates at least a temporary reprieve.
Right.
Is this sign of the times, another state saying we're not going to do this anymore? What's going on here?
Well, not just another state, but a state in the United States that is actually the seventh largest economy in the world.
That's incredible.
I mean, California, when California does something, it's like not the same as if Rhode Island does it. There's a little bit of a difference. But he's going by way of a moratorium because I think if he were to try to commute the sentences, he would need the legislature's approval. Mm-hmm. Or there's some mechanism in where he couldn't just do it sort of unilaterally in California. But he was very clear on his position on the death penalty and what his intentions were going to be if he was elected. And he was elected. So I'm sure that there will be, pushback to this. And again, for people who have, there's a quote actually in the story that where someone says, you know, we have some really horrible murders. We have a lot of serial killers in California. For people whose families have been, family members and loved ones have been, friends have been victimized in heinous ways, it's probably, and had their lives taken, it's probably very difficult for them. I think Newsom's calculation is different. Newsom is not looking at it so much from the point of view, and there are people that argue that he should be, of victims of these types of crimes. He's looking at it from the point of view of how frequently judgments to take a life, to execute a person who's been found guilty, are found later, sometimes when it's way too late, to have been wrong.
You know, this New York Times story points out that death penalty has been on decline for two decades in terms of support for it, and yet the Californians has voted in 2016 to keep it.
No, to speed it up, even arguably
because
speed
of the
up,
cost, right? And they respond to the idea that it's hugely costly by saying we'll do it faster.
Well, you know, I have to say, I'm against the death penalty. I know Marjorie is too. I'm troubled by that aspect of this. I mean, the people were asked what their position was,
right?
The people of Gavin Newsom's state. And I admire people of principle who decide to do things, even, you know, they're elected. And if you don't like what he did, don't vote for him next time. But not only, as Marjorie said, have there been ballot questions where they have, or at least a question where they have affirmed their support for the death penalty. As Marjorie said, in 2016, they approved Prop 66 to speed it up. The people did speak. It's not your interpretation, not yours, not Gavin Newsom's interpretation of what the people want. The people in the state said they not only want the death penalty, they want it speeded up. How relevant should that be to him on an issue of principle? Not?
I think it would be one thing if he had campaigned and given the impression that it was his intention to follow the will of the people. He was honest and said,
that's a very good point.
I understand that this is how you feel, but if you elect me, I will be the executive and I'll make decisions according to my own conscience. And if you vote for someone anyway, that means that you have made a calculation on balance, that that issue is not as important to you as the issues that you where you align with the person that you voted for and in the good things you think that person is going to do. So I think it's a calculation. And that, you know, people have expressed their opinion, but no one should be surprised that this is what Newsom is doing.
Well, you know, also, I've mentioned this before. While there's some dispute as to why Mario Cuomo lost his, one of my most, I admire him almost as much as any politician who I've seen up close and personal through the years. He lost his bid for, I think it was a third term. And if I recall, while there's some dispute about this, most analysts whom I've read through the years think that an ardent principled opponent of the death penalty, who I believe said in his third campaign, let the voters decide if New York State should have the death penalty, that a lot of people who had supported him felt it was such a compromise of his principled opposition, even if they disagreed with him on it or agreed with him on it, that that lost him votes. And ultimately, George Pataki, as we know, in a shocking upset, a guy virtually no one had ever heard of, beat Cuomo. So
you can't win. I mean, you have a choice. You can stand on your principle and risk everything, or you can say, like, you know, Kamala Harris says she is personally against the death penalty, but she follows the law. Mm-hmm. And if in this case the law would be, if a ballot question was passed, that's what, in her view, you should do, regardless of how
you
feel.
I think you made the most important point, though. As long as you didn't, if you're as a candidate, if you don't deceive the voters, that's
right.
A whole different. So if you said, I'm with you, and then flip,
right,
then there's a problem. But if you're honest about it and people don't agree with you but elect you anyway, then follow, adhere to your principle, particularly. I mean, we've had this discussion with you before. Even the Supreme Court, admittedly not with its more conservative turn, obviously with the most recent, with Kennedy's replacement by Kavanaugh, they had been moving in the direction in terms of age,
right,
in terms of mental disability and that sort of thing. You felt chipping away at this to the point where someday in the future we were going to not just have a moratorium in certain states,
well,
but
also an
abolition
globally.
Totally.
And it's an opposite to the things that we tell other countries
that's exactly right.
Used to tell other countries they needed to do to be more adherent to our moral principles. We don't say that as much anymore.
That is true. We're talking to Andrew Cabral, who is former Secretary of Public Safety and former Sheriff of Suffolk County.
So, Andrew Cabral, yesterday we were talking about this representative down in Georgia who's filed a testicular bill of rights because she wants to say that if we're going to have all these tough abortion laws, maybe we should have some tough laws that impact control over men's bodies as well. Then we have this story about Brian Kemp, who's the newly elected governor of Georgia. And remember, he ran against Stacey Abrams, and there was voter fraud.
Of course, suppression.
Yes, in that election. And yet he's taking this really tough stand, introducing this bill just a few days ago that would practically ban all abortions in the state if Roe v. Wade were to be thrown out, which is what I think a lot of anti-choice states are hoping with this new Supreme Court.
Well, he's shoring up all of those reliable, voters who vote solely on that issue in Georgia.
Do you believe that they're voting solely on that issue? I've become very suspicious about people who say they're voting. There are millions of legitimately pro-life people, and that's really their concern. But I'm beginning to think that this is a cover, that you're taking a morally superior cover, saying you're pro-life, when in fact you may be something else, like racist, because I thought it was very odd in that case down in Alabama with Roy Moore that all these people were saying, well, you know, in his case, that he was accused of trolling the malls for teenage girls, and people were saying, well, I have to vote for him because he's pro-life. I wasn't sure that that was true.
Well, that's why I don't refer to that as pro-life. I refer to it as anti-choice, and not just to be obstinate, but because there are numerous examples of people staking out sort of a pro-life position only when it comes to abortion, not when it comes to separating, ripping children
exactly.
from their parents' arms, including newborns, keeping kids in cages, not when it comes to the way children in foster care suffer and kids waiting to be adopted suffer. It only goes to the the incubation period of
right.
of
from conception
yes,
to birth.
From conception to birth. And I think, you know, you can certainly have that position, but to call that pro-life when there are numerous other instances of suffering where you don't champion the preservation of life, I think is somewhat hypocritical. But in any event, I think what Brian Kemp, his election is severely under question, and he knows that. And he is likely to get a challenger as soon as humanly possible. Might be Stacey Abrams again. And I think he's shoring up his base. But the law itself is absolutely, it's just a bill at this point that's been filed.
Yeah.
But the law itself is just absolutely insane.
Yeah,
did
up
you
to
mention,
10 years
by the
in prison for doctors, nurses,
oh, that's
and physicians'
what I was gonna say.
Assistants, and a fine of up to $100,000 if they were to perform.
But can I get
abortion.
Back to my optimistic self, which mm-hmm. I never am, but was 10 minutes ago, and I'll be again. I think it's good that he's filed this bill, because the line about, well, we hope Roe v. Wade isn't repealed, say some, but if it is, it
right.
doesn't mean the states
right.
can't protect you. It just means there'll be no federal constitutional right,
right.
Under the non-existent right to privacy, whatever Roe v. Wade is based on. Highlighting a law like this.
Exactly.
Oh, great, if you're in Georgia, as long as you can afford to drive to New York City,
right.
you'll be fine. But
right.
if you're in Georgia, you're screwed. Or if you're in Texas, where, well, that was overturned, their attempt to restrict abortion. But the goal has been not to be as sort of do as much of a frontal attack on Roe v. Wade as Georgia's talking about
right.
should it be repealed, but rather sort of chipping away through the
well,
back door.
I think that's absolutely right. And to file something preemptive like this, where Roe v. Wade is
that's
still the law
point,
of the
yeah.
land, they're basically saying, we want to do what would currently be a very unconstitutional thing, and we're desperately hoping that it becomes, that the constitutional prohibition gets lifted real soon.
We're short on time, but I'd want to broach this because this is much more controversial in my mind than it appears on its face. There is an effort by the Trump administration to expand criminal background checks for federal job applicants so that if it turns out they've been put in some diversion program rather than prison, the interviewer, the employer, would not know about it. And people are arguing that if the employer knows about it, it'll be discrimination against a whole class of people, particularly people of color, low-income people, all that sort of stuff. I want to know what your position is, and then I want to follow up on that. Where are you on this?
Well, first of all, the irony of the Trump administration suggesting that people have to report something as relatively innocuous as diversion versus, given the fact that the failure to report a rampant crime spree in a crime family seems to not, you know, bother the GOP at all is very interesting. But beyond that, the first thing I thought of when I read this was when we talked last year
exactly
about
what I was gonna bring up.
The lowering of the standards for the Customs Border Patrol.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah.
They lowered that they wanted to hire. Yeah. They knew that they were going to be holding immigrants at the border, and they needed to hire a lot of people very quickly, but people weren't getting through the stringent background check that existed even before this. So they lowered the standards, and now you're hearing a lot of stories about children in these detention centers being sexually abused, being physically abused, the parents being abused. That's what happens when you sort of lower your standards. With this, it's not about setting a standard for people to get into federal government. It's about delving into whether or not they've ever done something wrong and using that as a basis for keeping them out of federal government.
Well, let me take a totally counterintuitive position based upon what I thought you were going to mention that I think we discussed with you a couple years ago, and I can't remember what the term is, and maybe you will. There was a move, either state statutes, federal statutes under Obama or some such thing, to not allow employers to ask questions about certain criminal history.
Block
the box. That's what it is. Thank you. That essentially you have to make a conditional offer if you're going to make one. And after you make a conditional offer, then you can do the checking, but you're sort of committed. And the research was shocking that there was such bias against people of color who were applicants that employers discriminated more against people when
That's
they
right.
didn't. When they weren't required to disclose it because they assumed because of the color of their skin, they must have been in jail or committed a crime. And so essentially, in a perverse way, the reformers were arguing the reform is detrimental to the people you're trying to help. Isn't there the same potential on the federal level that the assumption is going to be that if you're a person of color or you're a poor person who's an applicant, you probably did something wrong. We're just not able to check into what horrible thing you did.
Yes, but I don't know how you overcome that. And I don't know that situation is helped by saying to people, if you went, and they say diversion programs, it's not clear from the story at what stage the diversion takes place. There are diversionary programs that people become part of at arraignment. There are some that happen pre-arraignment. There are some DA's offices that have programs that divert people before they ever end up coming before the court as a mechanism for keeping people out of the system. So it would have helped in the story to have some clarity around whether or not someone is diverted at the point of sentencing versus before that, and whether or not a guilty verdict ultimately issues. But the bottom line is that the federal government, unless it's a security clearance issue or some other kind of sensitive type of a position where you need to know everything about the person, whether or not they're susceptible to blackmail or bribery, they should be held to the same standard of only having convictions disclosed and misdemeanors or felonies depending upon what the federal law is.
Fair enough. Good to see you, Andrew
Good
Cabral.
Good to see you, too.
Thank you very much, Andrew Cabral. Andrew Cabral joins us every week for Law & Order. She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety and current CEO of Ascend. Thanks again, Andrea. Coming up, it's our Ambassador Roundtable. We're talking diplomacy and foreign affairs with not one, not two, but three former ambassadors. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Well, here we go. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When Kim Jong-un and President Trump's latest summit abruptly ended, speculation was that it might have ultimately compromised whatever goodwill was established first time around. But when it comes to diplomacy, particularly in these hyper-polarized times, is something, even a failed summit, better than nothing. Joining us to talk about this and more are three former U.S. ambassadors who are also going to tell us what exactly a U.S. ambassador does. We're joined by Rufus Gifford, former ambassador to Denmark. Nice to see you.
Great to be here.
Robert Barber, former ambassador to Iceland, current partner in the Boston law firm Prince Lobel. Good to see you.
Pleased to be here.
And Alan Solomon, who has been here before, dean of the Tisch College of Civic Life at Tufts University. He was the former ambassador to Spain and Andorra. Nice to see you, too.
Muchísimas gracias.
Oh, beautifully put.
Oh, wow. That was very, very impressive.
I have a feeling very that's Spanish. Like your former appointee. Remember when Barack Obama's great line was, I think it was when he was campaigning, and he was railing against the fact that we're virtually the only non-bilingual country in the world. He says, we say merci beaucoup when we think we're bilingual, which I thought was wonderful. Gentlemen, it's good to see you all. Thanks so much for being here.
So Jim was pointing out to me before that none of you gentlemen went to diplomacy school, right? You're political appointees. So was it a little nerve-wracking? We'll start with you, Alan. Was it a little bit nerve-wracking to go to Spain and be like a political guy? Or
first of all, some of us like to refer to it as non-career.
Thank you very much.
It's the greatest job in the world. You get up every morning and you work on the most important challenges facing the world, from nuclear non-proliferation to transnational terrorism to the economic crisis. The United States is unusual in that about a third of our ambassadors are non-career appointees. We bring some additional qualities, relationships, direct relationships with the president who we represent, experience in other arenas, whether it's the private sector or what have you. But we depend heavily on partnership with the amazing men and women who serve in the United States Foreign Service.
But before we move down the line here, was it not daunting, I guess, is Marjorie's question? No one's questioning your backgrounds, any of you, nor your desire to do the job well. But when you're thrust into something in mid or pre-midlife that you haven't done before that really has high stakes,
well, you know,
is there
Jim,
not some level of anxiety?
So you know I've had a bunch of different careers.
Yes, I do.
So this
that.
Was only the latest in a series of jobs I've had. I was for which I was totally unprepared.
Oh, perfect.
But in fact, we all studied hard for this. We spent a lot of time before we went over there learning our brief, understanding the country to which we had been posted, understanding the issues that we were going to deal with. We all have experience in sort of the world of politics and government and the public arena. I think maybe, to be honest, I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
How about you, Robert Barber, in Iceland?
Yeah, I think all of us were very much moved by the opportunity to be President Obama's personal representative to the country, to the post in which we served. And not that we needed any motivation, but to serve him to our best ability, I'd say we all worked very, very hard both before we went over, but every day that we were there, trying to be the best at it that we could be.
But was there any self-doubt, I guess, prior to the fact?
Well, I don't want to be unmodest and say I had no self-doubt. But to Alan's earlier point, the State Department does a fantastic job preparing one to be an ambassador. I think it's very helpful, and I'd say I know my brethren here pretty well through lots of experiences, but they are outgoing and interested in people with a fair degree of confidence and ability to do a job, whatever it may be.
Okay. We'll try this with you, Rufus.
I will have a slightly different answer.
A lot of lay people like myself have this notion that, you know, there's a lot of fancy dinner parties and there's a lot of fancy meet and greets and you better know where the knife goes and how many forks and you better know whether you're supposed to curtsy or not curtsy or shake hands sideways, whatever you're supposed to do. Any of that you encountered?
Lots of it. And yeah. I will say, look, I was a 38-year-old political staffer when the president asked me to serve overseas. And I have to say I was terrified. I really was.
Thank goodness.
I did not know how to do this job. I had spent my life in a very, very different sphere. And then all of a sudden, you get thrust into this incredibly intense process. But to Alan and Rob's points, you know, you had 9 months. I had 9 months, which is lightning speed through the process to prepare. But yes, you are meeting with intelligence services. You're meeting with the Pentagon. I guarantee you, I had never met with the Pentagon before I had been asked to serve overseas. So it is remarkable, but it's one of those things that it is like drinking from a fire hose. But the State Department does a remarkable job. preparing our people going overseas. But to your one real quick, your last point, the etiquette stuff is something no one prepares you for. I know Alan and I had to present our credentials to a monarch. I had to go and present my credentials to the Queen when I first arrived. And I had absolutely no idea what to do. And they tell you, but you still feel like you're doing it entirely wrong. So
But I want to clear up one misconception.
What's that?
This is not about
going to... It's not cocktail parties all day?
It is not cocktail parties. It is not fancy dinner parties. It is hard work. And the successful diplomats, whether they be career or non-career, are the ones that work hard on the work of the work and aren't distracted by the cocktail parties. You really are dealing with the biggest global issues facing us. And you can't afford to spend your time clicking...
You know, I have
glasses.
To say, in all fairness, you know Marjorie. Marjorie is distracted by cocktail parties, so
that's
one of the reasons. She,
that's right.
You know, before we get to, I think it's important you touch on a little bit what every day is like, a typical day for an ambassador. Before you do, all three of you mentioned the training and the preparation. We've been reading nonstop in the last 2 years about how there are scores, if not hundreds, of positions at the State Department that are unfilled. And while most of us say, well, okay, well, as long as you don't have the big ones unfilled, even though some of them are, what's the big deal? When you read further into these stories, they say one of the most serious adverse consequences of failing to fill these positions is on people like you who are trained, for whom security is provided by those in the State Department. Starting with you, Alan Solomon, former ambassador to Spain, what's the real-world consequence of this tsunami of vacancies in the Trump State Department?
There are probably 190 embassies around the world. Washington doesn't have the bandwidth to manage all of these bilateral relationships or all the multilateral relationships. It depends upon our diplomats, our embassies, to work on issues of national security and to work on issues of economic prosperity. One of the tragedies, I think, of this whole enterprise is that the American people don't appreciate how much value our diplomats, our foreign service officers, and our embassies provide for those of us here at home. And they are around issues of our security and our prosperity. So I was in Spain during the depths of the economic crisis. Our biggest fear is that if Spain fell into insolvency, it would impact our own economic recovery. We're too big a trading partner. And so I was constantly in contact with Washington and with the leadership in Madrid trying to help thread the needle so that Spain could survive the economic crisis without we weren't in a position to solve their problems, but it would have been... It would have been to our extreme detriment if Spain hadn't and Europe hadn't survived that period.
But so, Rob Barber, Rufus Gifford, though, I want to get back to the State Department. Would it have affected your life? How does it affect your successor's ability to do his or her job? Rufus Gifford, starting with you. Is it a big deal?
I think it's an enormous deal. And it's building off what Alan said. I think the flip side of this, not only is it more difficult for the U.S. government to do the job that we have been set out to do, look at it from the flip side, which is how the world views us, that the lack of prioritization that the U.S. government gives confirming someone as important in a host country like the U.S. ambassador feels like a slap in the face to some of our most trusted allies. And I think that is also a very, very important part of this conversation, which would never get reported here. But I guarantee you, there were some vacancies in the Obama administration, too, for a variety of different reasons. And I can tell you that those host governments were very, very upset that the administration had not prioritized that confirmation process. And I think right now we're just seeing that at an enormous level.
Are all three ambassadors, Spain, Iceland, and Denmark, confirmed now?
No.
Rob,
There is not an ambassador in Iceland. It took 19 months till August of 2018 for the president to nominate someone. And that person did not get even through the Foreign Relations Committee before the end of 2018. So he was renominated in January and is still pending. I looked this morning at the executive calendar of the Senate there, which is a listing of everybody who's been voted out of committee and is awaiting confirmation for one or another position. There are no ambassadors who are pending, even at that level. So they're all stuck in committee for one or another reason.
Do you agree with what Rufus Gifford says, that it makes a statement to the leadership of that country about how low a priority it
is? Yeah, I agree completely. It is taken as an offense, a bit of an offense, not a deep offense. But there was a gap between the departure of Luis Arriaga, great ambassador who preceded me, and my arriving. It was 14 months. And the embassy, Paulo Freire was the DCM, who the deputy chief of mission becomes the chargé d'affaires. The title changes because he is temporarily running the embassy.
Until there's a new ambassador.
At post. And Paul did a fantastic job. And Jill Esposito, who's there now, is doing a fantastic job. But it is not the same. The person who serves in that role is not seen as having the same status as an ambassador. That person is not the personal representative of the president. And it's really very, very tough.
That's the voice of Robert Barber, former ambassador to Iceland. Before him, you heard Rufus Gifford, former ambassador to Denmark, and Ellen Solomon is the former ambassador to Spain.
Well, Jim has been talking about this, the budget cuts and diplomacy and the less security for people that are in the diplomatic corps and all that. What's this about? What do people think that this is about in the Trump administration, this pushback, this pullback? What's it about?
Well, of course, we've all left our posts on or before January 20th, 2017, so we haven't had, in any formal sense, interactions with folks from our former host governments. But all of us have been back to country and have had meetings of one sort or another. And I can say from the Iceland perspective, there is concern. Secretary Pompeo was there last month. So it was a bit of an effort at knitting. But there are lots of disagreements, I think, and concerns with respect to U.S. policy these days. But I will also say, in Iceland's case, and I would expect these guys to be able to comment, but in Iceland's case, there's a deep and abiding relationship with the United States. I was a caretaker for the time that I was there. Other ambassadors serve those functions, but the relationship, which we all try to advance in our time at post, but the relationship is a core relationship.
So, do you want to say something about that? Yeah,
well, okay. President Obama.
This is Alan Solomon.
President Obama used to say, "The problems of the world are too big to be solved by America alone, but no big problem can be solved by America itself, without America." Mm-hmm. Excuse me. That's the nature of the world we live in. We are both need to partner with like-minded countries and with countries with whom we differ, and we have to lead in order to maintain security, stability, prosperity. This administration has walked away from that in the most disheartening and shocking way. I mean, it's just beyond the pale. And as a result, the United States is one— not partnering, we're not working with other countries around global problems, and we are not leading other countries. And that is going to be in our long-term bad interests.
Rufus Gifford.
Really briefly, I would just say this. I would say that the concern, and I do spend a lot of time back in Europe still, the concern on the ground, I would say, is profound. And I just want to explain why. We have to realize that a lot of these countries, we all represented European countries, that for the last 75 years, that the peace and security and prosperity of the West has been centered around this incredibly strong transatlantic alliance, right? And whether that was the economics of it or, of course, NATO. For the first time in that last 75 years, we have a president of the United States who is questioning this alliance actively and criticizing. I was watching on my way over here a meeting that he was having with the Irish Prime Minister, where he said over and over again how that the EU is screwing over the United States. And let's be clear, the Europeans are not comfortable with this, and I think that they are legitimately concerned, and with good reason.
So what I asked you a couple of minutes ago, if you could tell us what we have no – Marjorie and I talked a lot before, and we spent some time with you recently, Alan, and you gave us a sense of what daily life is like, but most listeners weren't there. And by the way, Alan's wife, we should say. Are we allowed to promote this?
Absolutely.
Susan Solomon is writing a book about the life of a wife of a diplomat. When's her book coming out, and what's it called?
Her book is coming out on March 26, 1699. You can pre-order it on Amazon. Pathetic. It is Lost and Found in Spain, Tales of an Ambassador's Wife. And it's a story of this a woman who leaves her work, a life she loved, to accompany her husband, who's going to be a diplomat, and how she found her own voice in spite of the efforts of the State Department to marginalize her.
Ooh.
I've already ordered 10 copies.
I bet you have. $16.99.
Did I say it was $16.99?
Can we go around quickly and say, give us one thing about the daily life of a diplomat that most of us would not have expected. Now, we know you, you're a TV star, obviously. In Denmark, you might not have wanted to tell that story, but you were. I mean, how did that happen? Oh, don't shake your head.
No, it's such a crazy story, though, Jim. I didn't expect it. My goal as ambassador was to humanize this remarkable work of diplomacy. People like Robin Allen and I know that the work that is done by these incredible men and women every single day is underreported. I think the question that you start with, which is what does an ambassador do, is the exact same question my parents asked me when I told them I was going to be an ambassador. Because it sounds great, and it sounds like a lot of cocktail parties and hanging out with the queen. And it's not that. It's so much more meaningful. So for me, I wanted to tear down the walls and show people who didn't have access to this remarkable world what an ambassador did. And that's why we decided to let TV cameras in. Now, admittedly, I thought 4,000 people would watch this thing. It had ended up being bought by Netflix. And so, but
you were like a reality TV star in Denmark, right? Is that not fair statement?
That is absolutely the case.
It is. I know it is. I've seen some of this.
Well, it is probably true.
Yeah.
Yes.
Survivor, Denmark edition.
But the goal was to directly connect with the people there, right?
100%. I like to call it a documentary series, not a reality show, to distinguish myself from the Kardashians.
So, Rob Arbor, tell us, again, a piece of a day that most of us might not expect.
Well, part of what you're asking Rufus about and he's describing is a role, a function of an ambassador, which is the public diplomacy aspect of an embassy and the ambassador who leads it. And that is being out and about, showing yourself as that personal representative of the president. I tried every day. I mean, there was some part of that in most every day. But I tried every day to advance the bilateral relationship in some fashion. And whether it was by meetings with government leaders or whether they're of the opposition party or ruling coalition folks, or other ministers in the government, trying to help knit collaborations and commercial relationships, cultural. That was a part of the job, and to the point that these guys were making, that we all tried to make very substantive improvements in those relationships.
And do you eat whale ice cream? Or whatever the hell it is? What is that stuff? Is it called whale ice cream? Is that what it is?
I
obviously,
the answer
didn't.
Is no, I didn't, because it was contrary to U.S. policy.
Oh,
commercial
oops.
Whaling.
Sorry,
yeah,
excuse me.
Was,
sorry
so,
about that.
Not very diplomatic.
So, we're encouraging.
I'll withdraw that question. It's okay.
Non-consumption of whale products. Go whale watching when you're in Iceland. I'll be glad to help you with
deal.
Whale watching out.
Oh, see the Northern Lights from Iceland?
Yes, of course.
How is that? It's my dream. Is that unbelievable?
Yes. We'll
fine.
We'll talk about that.
So, Alan, we're going to read your wife's book. So, right. But we got to wait. What is it? 14 days or whatever it is for the book. Give us one element of the life of the ambassador to Spain.
Well, I was the ambassador of all of the American people to all of the people of Spain. So I spent about a quarter or a third of my time outside of Madrid. So for the typical day, I'd get up at 6 in the morning, catch a 7 o'clock high-speed rail to Barcelona. I'd be there in a couple of hours. On the way, I'd read my brief. I'd read all the paper they gave to me. And every time I traveled outside of Madrid, I'd want to do a series of things. I'd want to meet with the local press because everybody wants to talk to the U.S. ambassador, and that was my megaphone. And I would talk about the close relationship between the United States and Spain and the people of Barcelona and Catalonia. I'd usually meet with businesses, either Spanish companies doing business in the United States or U.S. companies that had a presence in Barcelona. I would I try to go out in a place where ambassadors didn't typically go. So I might go to a community center in this neighborhood in Barcelona that in which there were a lot of Pakistani and immigrants and immigrants from Muslim countries, and would meet with them, maybe have a round table. My wife would frequently accompany me, and since one of our goals was to eat in as many Michelin star restaurants as we can, we would probably, you know, and we had a plan of date night once a week, so we might eat at a fine restaurant that evening. But I would be going from, you know, 6 in the morning till 7 at night, and trying to cover as many. I'd go and visit with the leaders of the government. And
who paid for the restaurants?
We paid for the restaurants.
You did.
We paid for the restaurants. The high-speed rail, which I took coach, was covered by the embassy. Uh-huh. the thing about our jobs is we had, because we were the representative of the President of the United States, we had enormous access. There wasn't a door that wasn't open to us. So I'd go and meet with the regional president of the, you know, in Catalonia. I remember coming out of a meeting with the president of Spain. We spent about an hour together. And I said to my DCM who was with me, I said, you know, I couldn't get an hour with a deputy assistant secretary of state in Washington.
So true. That is pretty great. We're talking to Alan Solomon, former ambassador to Spain, Robert Barber, former ambassador to Iceland, Rufus Gifford, former ambassador to Denmark.
You know, Robert Barber, there was a lot of talk when the president was meeting with the leaders of North Korea and how much normally there's all this diplomacy that goes on for weeks, if not months, before that. And then when the two leaders of the countries get together, it's sort of to seal the deal. I know you were with Obama when he met with the Nordic leaders in Iceland. And I'm just wondering, how unusual was that, that there seemed to be, from at least the news reporting, not that much diplomacy in the background of the North Korea-United States summit?
Well, speak first to our experience, and it was actually the Nordic summit at the White House in May of 2016. So it included the five Nordics, Denmark and Iceland, two of those five. And Rufus knows, as I do, the enormous amount of preparation and planning on the substantive side that went into getting the issues briefed, discussed in some part by folks in the embassy, but a lot of that is handled from Washington too, so that when the leaders do meet, it is substantive to be sure, but there's agreements that have already been reached ahead of that, or the basis for finalization of agreements. All that groundwork has been laid. And so you do have a successful summit. You know, an unsuccessful summit is not simply due to a lack of preparation and a lack of planning and all of that effort. The Gorbachev-Reagan summit in Iceland in 1986 ended actually as a failure at that moment in October of 86. It turned out that all that was not agreed to there but discussed became the basis for the treaties that ended the Cold War. But you need the preparation and the planning in order for it to be successful. These things don't happen by force of personality.
You know, one last thing related to this for Alan Solomon, Rufus Gifford. Many believe, I am among them, that talking is better than not. I think Barack Obama believed that too. He took a lot of criticism for that. But Trump was the first president to meet with a North Korean leader. The second one, I think the consensus was there was virtually no preparation for and was not only a failure, to a degree an embarrassment. But the fact that there is a dialogue when there's a nuclear threat, is that not better, even if he didn't handle it as he should have, than there not to have been one, Alan Solomon?
I mean, on balance, I think the answer is yes. But it was a wasted effort. It didn't produce anything. This isn't the first period in our history where the United States has kind of withdrawn and looked inward. And if you go back to the 50s and look at what happened there, some of our adversaries desperately wanted relationships with the United States. I mean, Ho Chi Minh wanted a relationship. Fidel Castro, the Chinese who had, the communist Chinese who had come to power. And there was there were people in the State Department encouraging outreach, and yet there were other forces and the McCarthy forces who said, oh, no, we're not. And so what happened? We went to war. What did we get? We got the Korean War. We got the Vietnamese War. And we got a 50-year embargo on Cuba. You pay a price for these things. And there are only two ways to work in the international arena, either with force or with diplomacy. And I'd pick diplomacy on any day of the week. And you know, knowing that there are some things, problems that can't be solved by diplomacy, and then you have other options.
Rufus Kiffer, you can get the last words on the summit.
Absolutely. First of all, I am supportive of the idea of modernizing your diplomatic effort, modernizing your diplomatic approach. Look at what Obama did with places like Cuba, places like Iran, saw policies that have been in place for decades that I believe were not working, he believed were not working, and modernized them. I think that engaging the North Koreans probably is the right step, but it's not just about the policy. It's about the tactics. Look at the way the Obama administration approached the Iran deal, right? This took years and years and years of changing policy. You had remarkable diplomats, people like Wendy Sherman, people like John Kerry, who'd go to Vienna over and over and over again, sit around the table with negotiators and figure out how to get the JCPOA done. And they did it. This does not happen overnight. Those summits are mostly photo op, and we know it, that the stuff has been agreed on in advance. And the problem you have when you foreign policy by the seat of your pants or whatever you got here, I just do not think it serves the American people and the international community.
We're just about out of time, but I just want to be sure before you guys go that after being ambassadors, are you all more polite now? Do you find that you're more gracious? You're more a little bit less slower to anger? That
well,
kind
I
of
don't
thing.
Think Rufus or Alan could have been any more polite.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's
but
beautiful.
But you're improved.
That's
so you're an improved product.
I am improved, very definitely.
I am 5 years older. That is what has made me calmer and whatever. Did I mention my wife's book?
No, you have. What's the name of it? How much is it on for pre-sale, please?
It comes out on March 26th. It's by Susan Solomon. Yeah. It's Lost and Found in Spain, Tales of an Ambassador's Wife. It's $16.99. You can pre-order it on Amazon.
We might even find some space for her on the show, Alan Solomon. Pass the word along. Gentlemen, I really enjoyed this. I hope you'll do it again. This is really great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
First, Jim.
Well, first of all, we hope is many.
One roof. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming in. Rufus Gifford is former ambassador to Denmark. Robert Barber is former ambassador to Iceland, current partner of the law firm of Prince Lobel. And Alan Solomon is dean of the Tisch College of Civic Life at Tufts University.
Doing some of the great research on young voters, by the way, out there, Alan Solomon.
Thank you.
And Alan Solomon was, of course, ambassador to Spain and Andorra. Thank you all again for coming in. Coming up, a new documentary from Frontline looks at war crimes and the trial of one of the most infamous figures in the Balkan Wars. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And a new Frontline documentary goes inside the war crimes trial of Ratko Mladic, one of the most infamous figures of the Balkan Wars of the 90s. It's 5 years in the making, and producer Henry Singer made it by gaining exclusive access to both the prosecution and defense teams. The trial of Ratko Mladic airs next Tuesday, March 19th, on GBH2 at 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. To learn more, to go to pbs.org/WGBH/frontline. Henry, congratulations, and thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, a thrill to talk to you, too, Henry. I'm a huge fan. So tell us, all these horrible atrocities occurred quite some time ago in the 90s, but the trial was much more recent, 6-year trial. Tell us why.
Well, the trial took place at something called the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which was set up by the United Nations, I think, in 93, when there were already reports of atrocities in Bosnia and in the other regions in the former Yugoslavia. The tribunal was set up while the war was still going on. And once the war ended, someone like Ratko Mladic went into hiding. And when I say hiding, it's you have to put it in inverted commas, because It was well known from time to time where he was. He was, as you'll see in the film, he's a beloved figure in Republika Srpska, which is one of the two entities of the country of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And so it took a long time for the ICTY and for forces to hunt down people like Mladic. And so that's the reason why you have such a huge gap between the establishment of the ICTY and the actual arrest, because there wasn't the political will to actually find someone like Mladic, and it was really only when Bosnia decided it wanted to become part of the European Union that real efforts were made to locate and find him and arrest him.
Henry,
and bring him to The Hague for the
trial.
Can
we back up a little bit for those who don't know of the crimes of Mladic, what he was charged with, what he was convicted of, I think, in 2017. Could you lay him out for our listeners, please?
Yeah, I mean, he was basically charged with 11 counts. The two most serious, which we focus on in the film, were for genocide in Srebrenica, which many viewers and listeners today will recognize. That was the massacre of 7,000 Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica in July 1995. And then a second count of genocide in what's called the municipalities, which is the country is divided up into municipalities. And in six different municipalities, he was charged with genocide, including one in Prijedor, which we'll no doubt get to, which is partly the focus of the film. The other nine counts, they were war crimes and crimes against humanity. And I don't have the specifics in front of me, but war crimes include things like torture, taking hostages, killing civilians as hostages, and crimes against humanity are things like ethnic cleansing, deportation. That's basically a war crime that's really a systematic attack on a population. But the two most serious were the genocide charges, and that's the attempt to eliminate in whole or in part an ethnic population.
You know, I know, Henry, there were hundreds and hundreds of witnesses, but I don't think you have to go much beyond the first witness in the trial to get the emotional impact of this. We're going to play a little clip. This is a guy who was only a kid, a child, when he lost his father and uncle during these killings, and he relives this harrowing moment during his testimony against Mladic. As I say, he's the first prosecution witness in the case. Please listen.
We were instructed to form three lines and to lay down in this puddle of mud and water. I was laying down next. My dad was on my left-hand side, and my uncle was on my right-hand side. And as I was laying down, they ordered us to all the women and children to get up. And at first, I didn't want to get up because I was afraid to separate from my dad. And he told me to get up. I told him, no, I don't want to go without you. He says, get up. I said, oh. And my uncle insisted. He says, get up. You will survive. Since I'm reliving and going back to this, I had a dream about my dad last night. For the first time, I was able to see his face. I'm glad, because most of the dreams, nightmares that I have from the personal experience, I was always trying to reach him. I saw his face last night. I miss my dad. Let me find my dad. Please. I would like to find my dad.
That is just unbelievable. He is surely not alone, Henry, in this film.
No, he's not alone in the film. We really focus on. There were so many survivors we could have filmed with. We focus on Elvedon. That's Elvedon Passage, mm-hmm. who's an extraordinary man. Now lives in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm at a conference right now with him. So I spent the evening with him last night, and there was a panel discussion, and he was asked to sort of retell the story, part of which you just heard in the film. And it gives you a sense. I mean, he's a little over 40 now. He was 14 at the time. And watching him choke up last night once again. I think probably the main purpose of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is to really to try to bring justice for people like Elvedin. And we talked already about the delay between the indictment, the arrest, and the trial. But for people like Elvedin, I think he'd wait his whole life for the moment to see someone like Ratko Mladic in the dock.
Has he seen the film?
Yeah, he's seen the film.
And?
Yeah, I think he admires it enormously. I mean, it's obviously very, very painful for him to watch the film because, and I'm sure we'll get to this, but, the film is very balanced. I think it makes it unusual that we look at both the prosecution and the defense. But I think he's really thrilled that he participated in the film. And we look at the stories of two other survivors. There's a woman named Celia Osmanovic, who lost her husband and two sons in Srebrenica. And we interview her out where she lives, outside the town of Srebrenica still. She lives there because it's the only place where she has memories of her family. And it's extraordinarily moving. We're with her in the house, and she only has two pictures of her sons, and they're from school photos because the house was burned down at the time. And she's extraordinarily brave to come to The Hague and to testify. And then the third survivor we interview is a woman named Elvira, who lives in Prijedor, who hopes, and I can expand on this later, but she hopes that during the filming, a mass grave was discovered, and she hopes so much that her father's remains will be found in the grave. So the role of a war crimes tribunal is partly, if not entirely, to bring justice for survivors like that.
You know, you have the second witness you spoke about, the widow who lost her husband and her sons and had the school age pictures. You have a scene of the father calling out in this big, huge field. Tell people about that.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary piece of archive. Essentially, what happened is that Celia's youngest son was killed by shrapnel when the bombing started. And then she and her husband and older son, escaped from the village and went to Srebrenica. And at one point they decided, because they thought it gave them a greater chance to survive, that the son and father would flee to the woods. And the father at one point was captured. And we have footage in the film of the father being forced by Serb soldiers to cry out to his son Nerman to tell him and the others to come down from the woods, that it's fine with the Serbs, it's safe here, come down. And as you can guess, and as one surmises in the film, obviously, both father and son were subsequently murdered. So it's an extraordinarily powerful and painful piece of film to watch a father forced to bring his son down, and then the son is subsequently killed. And that piece of footage, most of the archive, or a lot of the archive in the film, was used as testimony in the trial, and that piece of footage was used during Saliha's testimony, and we see it again when she's in court.
Yes.
And the prosecutor asks her, do you recognize the man in the picture? And there in front of everybody, weeping, as you can imagine, she identifies that as her husband.
Yeah. I think she said, "That is my man," which I thought was a very interesting way to put it. You know, I realize I should have asked you this before. And by the way, we're talking with Henry Singer, and he's the producer behind the new Frontline documentary, The Trial of Ratko Mladic. You talked about how Mladic was beloved in by the Serbians, and that enabled him to stay hidden for so long. Explain to people who may be too young or just have forgotten what was going on over there after Tito left Yugoslavia and between the Muslim Serbians in quotes. What was the whole problem?
Well, after Tito died, I mean, before Tito died, there was sort of economic instability, and there were, it was difficult times for the country. Tito dies. Tito was Tito was a beloved figure. I mean, he was authoritarian, and you know, there have always been concerns that you know, perhaps he was repressive in some ways to political opponents. But he was beloved, and he kept that country together. And after his death, the country essentially fell apart, and the various republics started to break away. And Bosnia was, after Slovenia and Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina voted for independence. The Serbs wanted to stay in larger Yugoslavia, but the Bosnians and the Croats voted against it. And essentially the country just fell apart and went into war. And what Mladic did, he was the soldier on the ground, and Karadzic, the politician, who was also tried by the ICTY, was to try to establish really a greater Serbia, and at least a Serbian republic within Bosnia. So out of their efforts grew something called Republika Srpska, the Republic of Srpska in Bosnia, which the Dayton agreements in the mid-90s actually consolidated into a sort of a separate federation in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So it's a very – so it would not have been hard and was not hard for Mladic to go into hiding and to have great support. I mean, as we show in the film, there's sort of an extraordinary sequence, which is called Mladic Day, which every year on his birthday near his birthplace – a large group of Mladic supporters meet to toast and sing songs about their leader, and they and they're representative of a much larger population believe that the ICTY really is a sort of a kangaroo court, and that there's a Western bias against Mladic. So you have. The film shows this the deep polarization that still exists. In fact, it exists as much now as it did then between Serbs and Muslims. So the film ends as you both know with Mladic being found guilty of 10 out of 11 counts. But we end the film seeing Saliha, who I've mentioned already, yes, a survivor from Srebrenica, and another witness who was Mladic's driver during the war and while he was in Srebrenica. And you see the two at the end, and what we're trying to really suggest without saying to the audience is that this may have come down as a judgment, but has it brought the country closer together? Probably not.
You know, Henry Singer, you, as I mentioned, hundreds of witnesses, multi-year trial, thousands of documents. I want to talk to you about how you approach that to begin with. But you went out of your way a couple of minutes ago correctly to say that you attempted to get every angle of this from behind the scenes, including the defense. One of the more chilling lines, here's Mladic's defense lawyer refusing to apologize on behalf of his client, the general. Here it is.
We have the instruction from the general to say sorry to a victim, and I never do that. It's not my job. Although he instructs me that, no. My job is to cross-examine. I'm a lawyer. I cross-examine. If you want to apologize, write a letter.
Why did everybody agree to allow you in as much as they did here, Henry Singer?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jim. I think we approached the tribunal late in the tribunal's life. I mean, Mladic was the last trial there. And this was a group of people, judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, who had been working for over 20 years bringing alleged war criminals to justice and defending alleged war criminals, I should say. And I think there was a kind of feeling in the building that they'd been doing this work and the world didn't know about it. So I think in terms of getting the institution and the judges on board, I think that was crucial. I mean, anybody who makes films and tries to get access to institutions, and particularly institutions that have never let a documentary crew inside, will know that timing is crucial. And I think we were lucky in the sense that we came in at the end, towards the end of the life of the tribunal, and there was a feeling that, you know, we've been doing this work. No one's really aware of it. Maybe we should trust these guys, because I should mention that I co-produced this with a very fine filmmaker named Rob Miller, that we should let these guys in. Now, that I think that answers the sort of the judges and the prosecution side. On the defense side, I think the defense on some level felt they had nothing to lose. Mm. I mean, Mladic was already known as the quote-unquote butcher of Bosnia. I think there was a general feeling that he was guilty of these crimes. They felt they'd never really had a fair shake at it in the media, at least the Western media. And so I think for them, their calculation was these two guys seemed decent, and we don't have a huge amount to lose. But it was tricky, as you can imagine, because we were swinging back and forth between meetings with the prosecution and meetings with the defense. And so we had to also assure them that we would set up a Chinese wall, that we would obviously never share anything from either side. So I think we got lucky with the timing. I think that was really probably the largest. But it took weeks of negotiation. And once you're in, you sort of have to earn your spurs, if that's the cliche, all the time. And one of the great challenges of the film is you can build up making these kinds of films is all about relationships, and you can build up relationships with the Mladic defense team, and you can build up relationship with the prosecutors, but you've got these witnesses coming in all the time who don't know you and don't know your work, and don't know if you're trustworthy. The prosecution has a very big team. New prosecutors would come onto the Mladic trial, and you'd have to sort of renegotiate with them. So it was one of a lot of challenges of making a big film on a really big institution that had real legal sensitivities around it.
You know, there were so many great scenes, but I wanted to touch on a couple more. And by the way, we're talking to Henry Singer. He's the producer behind the trial of Ratko Mladic. One of them was the scene of prisoners in what almost looked like World War II concentration camps. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, one of the stories that, making this kind of film, this kind of observational filmmaking is, there's a certain amount of luck involved. And we got lucky in the sense that at one point we got a tip that potentially the largest mass grave in Bosnia had been discovered in the municipality of Prijedor in northeast Bosnia. And so we were there extraordinarily early when archaeologists were starting to unearth bodies. And you see that briefly in the film. And you see, subsequently, you see the morgue, and you see, viewers should be warned, really, there are some and we can talk about why we chose to put this kind of imagery in, but there's some rather graphic images of corpses and a hand with a ring and that kind of imagery. Though that grave was peopled with individuals who would have been held in camps, the most famous of which is Ormarska, where Muslims were rounded up. This is according to the prosecution, and put in camps, systematically killed. And the imagery of those camps, again, the most famous of them is Ormarska, is very much pictures of, and it's heartbreaking and difficult to look at, very, very, very emaciated men and teenage boys. And they are very reminiscent of the kind of images that we all know from the Holocaust. And it's in the film, and there is that iconic image, which is a still taken from an ITV news crew. That's a British news crew that were the ones to break the story of an extraordinarily thin man behind barbed wire. Some listeners will remember this. And that image sort of went round the world, and I think sort of was instrumental in waking people up.
Yep.
To what was going on in the former Yugoslavia, and the comparisons to the Holocaust were very much talked about then. And it is, they're searing images.
Well, one last thing, Henry. What's life like for Mladic today?
Well, Mladic right now has returned to the detention center. When someone's on trial at the ICTY, they are kept in a detention center in The Hague, which is, as you can imagine, is a prison-like structure, rather modern with barbed wire around it. I think the accommodations are not the kinds of ones that we would they won't compare to an American prison. They're a good deal nicer. And he's appealing his guilty verdict. So he waits there for his appeal. And if the judgment is upheld, he will then be sent to another country to serve out his life sentence.
Henry, we are out of time, but congratulations. This was a usually upsetting but usually important piece of work, so I thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you both.
Henry Singer is a critically acclaimed producer behind the new Frontline documentary, The Trial of Ratko Mladic. It airs Tuesday, March 19th on WGBH at Channel 2 at 9 o'clock. To learn more about it, go to pbs.org/WGBH/Frontline. Coming up, we're going to talk to Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab, and she's going to talk to us about the oceans getting warmer and changing colors and what grapes do in your microwave oven. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Join us online to go over the latest environmental headlines as GBH's science correspondent Heather Goldstone. Heather's an expert in ocean science and the host of Living Lab Radio, which you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 and Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on WCAI 90.1. Hello, Heather.
Hi.
Hey, Heather. Great to talk to you. So I think a lot of us suspected this before, but now apparently there's some science behind it. The idea that white people are mainly the cause to blame for pollution, but people of color bear the burden of that pollution. What's the study say?
Right. So this is a new study, which, as you said, they even say in their introduction, like, this is something that we've kind of had an intuitive sense of, but what they wanted to do was really quantify, and specifically with regard to air pollution and air pollution deaths. So they say there are about 100,000 premature deaths due to air pollution in the U.S. every year, and that this was kind of amazing to me. About over 90% of those are actually due to personal consumption here in the U.S. So we're doing this to ourselves, but it's not equal, both because white is the majority ethnicity right now, and also because of income disparities, white people are doing most of that consuming, or more disproportionately more of that consuming. But because, again, of income disparities and where neighborhoods of color tend to be, they're exposed to much more. And so the end result is that, in fact, white Americans are exposed to something like 17% less pollution than what is proportionate to what they're actually consuming. And Black and Hispanic Americans are consuming 50 to 65% more pollution than what they're actually producing. So really put some numbers to just how stark this disparity is.
And you think of all the stories you hear in the inner cities about asthma.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, which is obviously a real problem. Heather, another really scary story today about this vanishing safety window. I think we had this notion that was just said just a little while ago that if we could keep the down to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit increase, we'd be not great, but okay. Now it's less than 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, so what it is we've got these two, yeah, and in Fahrenheit, the numbers make absolutely no sense, right?
So glad you said that.
Those are completely random numbers, and it kind of drives home the point that they're random numbers. But in Celsius, they're at least random round numbers. They're 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius, and those may be the numbers that you've heard, you know, bandied about for years as the goals that we're trying to reach. We're trying to limit total increase in global average warming to less than 2 degrees, ideally closer to 1.5 degrees above what it was like in the mid to late 1800s. And that's because looking at the likely effects of that much average warming, you know, what that would mean in terms of extreme temperatures and extreme weathers, heat, drought, flooding, all of those different things, that staying within that window was thought to be relatively safe and would also avoid some of these what are called tipping points, where like we could hit a point where there's enough melting in the Arctic that it becomes a runaway feedback. And so that's where those 1.5 or 2 degree numbers came from. And so then the question over the past few years has been, OK, can we actually still do that, given that we've waited something like, you know, 20, 30 years since we started getting this science and really understanding what needed to happen? Do we still have time to hit those goals, and what would it take? And we got a report late last fall that made huge headlines, right, and basically said, like, we've got 12 years to do this. Which was a little bit misleading in and of itself, because what it actually said was more like we need to be done in 12 years, not we need to do this in 12 years. And that was one estimate of what it would take to stay under 1.5 degrees total warming. This new study that you're talking about paints an even more dire situation, where they say, actually, you know, we did our estimates with assuming that the climate is a little bit more responsive to carbon dioxide. It takes less to cause more warming. We think that's a more realistic way of looking at it. And in fact, and they assumed that we would not spend, I think it's more than 3% GDP globally on efforts to address climate change, and that we wouldn't use any sort of carbon capture, any technologies that would suck carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere. This is just plain old, we need to cut emissions. And they said, at this point, with those constraints, it's almost impossible to stay under 1.5, and we've got to be at net neutral by 2030. You know, any emissions that we do put up in terms of greenhouse gases would have to be offset in some way by 2030 in order to stay under 2 degrees. So it's just adding to this ongoing drumbeat of science showing that we've got a really daunting task in front of us to try to limit the extent of global warming to something that would be manageable in the decades ahead.
Let's talk about that 2030 deadline for a second. Let's assume we're saying, and now joining us on the line is Heather Goldstone, and it's whatever day today is, March 14th, I think, not of 2019.
It's Pi Day, 3.14.
Oh, that's right. It's Pi Day. I forgot about that. But March 14th of 2030. What's the conversation we're having today when we haven't met the goals within the time frame that was established both by that intergovernmental council that was dismissed, of course, by the head of the government, Donald Trump, and the thing you're talking about today? What's the conversation then, Heather?
So assuming we haven't gotten not at net zero, and it's 2030. So here's the thing with climate change that often, I think, contributes to why we've waited so long. And that's that by 2030, we may or may not have hit 1.5 or 2 degrees C, and we certainly will not have seen the full impacts of that warming by 2030. There's a lag time in the climate system, right? And so we will be seeing more extreme weather than we are today. We will see more extreme highs, fewer extreme lows, more of the droughts and floods and wildfires that we've seen increasing in recent years. Things will be more extreme, but we certainly won't be there, wherever there ends up being the end of the story.
But I guess I get to elicit that answer. But what I also meant to ask was, what will those same scientists be saying should those deadlines that they said needed to be met were not met? What will they be saying about the future?
You know, they may be saying something very similar to what they're saying right now, which is that this is not a set of like hard and fast, here's the deadline, here's the end date, here's exactly what will happen, mm-hmm. right? Catherine Hayhoe is a leading climate scientist and a fabulous climate communicator. And we talked to her toward the end of 2018, kind of about all of the reports that had come out in 2018 and what to make of them. And she said, bottom line, what we should make of all of these reports is that every action, every day, every year matters. And the sooner we do more, the better off we will be. And that's not going to have just a solid end date until perhaps we are at net zero.
Okay, so
you just get the sense that we're just going to burn up and that's going to be that. I mean, I really,
but it's the squishiness of this, and I don't mean that in a horrible way. It's probably a horrible choice of words that allows the deniers to be deniers, don't you think?
Well, once again, though, it seems like it's the politicians that are the deniers. The American public seems to understand this to at least a certain degree, if you believe the polls, Heather.
Heather? Whoops. Must have been something you said, Marjorie, that caused her to... I would have hung up on you in the middle of that, too. Because, you know, when you're questioning about the American people, they're efforting getting Heather.
Oh, they're efforting.
But you know why I hope she is not gone for good?
Because you want to talk about the grapes.
I have done
microwave.
This grape thing in the microwave maybe only 100,000 times in my life. And I thought it was just a fun kind of thing. But it turns out there's some scientific... something that comes out of this. Is this happening or is she gone for
so
good?
Jim and Marguerite, I don't know if you can still hear me, but I'm hearing
back.
The Brexit vote.
What's that? What did you just say?
She's hearing the Brexit vote, she said.
Sorry.
There's some problem. Some mechanical
this
problem.
This is horrible. Sorry. Yeah. Heather.
Hi, are you guys there?
Do you hear us now?
Yeah, I just did a little bit of world travel to the Brexit vote.
Oh, well, okay.
Welcome back. You know, we only have a couple minutes left.
Yeah.
But I've only read the first couple of paragraphs of a story in the New York Times that I printed out the other day. I have done this thing with grapes in the microwave, as I said to Marjorie, I don't know if you heard, maybe 100,000 times, because I love the image. One, you can describe what it is, but two, I had no idea that this experiment that I was doing, I didn't know it was an experiment, might have broader scientific implications. Could you describe the fun part and tell us who cares?
So I'm sitting here amazed. I'd somehow missed this whole grapes
Not
in the microwave
me.
Thing completely. You've been doing it for ages. I did it for the first time a couple of days ago and was blown away.
Go ahead,
so
describe it.
You put two grapes. You can use whole grapes or cut in half grapes next to each other. The important thing is they need to be touching each other. Mm-hmm. You can actually do it with blueberries, olives, cherries.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. There's a whole world out there. Put two of them next to each other in the microwave. Give them a few seconds in the microwave, and you'll probably at least get some sparks between them, and you might actually get this kind of glowing electric cloud above them, and that's actually plasma. So you can make plasma, the fourth form of matter, in your microwave with a couple of pieces of fruit. And the thing is, this has been like a YouTube sensation for decades, but we didn't know why. And actually, most of the explanations that were out there were wrong. They kind of described it as an antenna effect, and instead, what it turns out is that the microwaves kind of get trapped in these balls of water, which is essentially what those fruits are. It creates hot spots that then kind of merge and spark. And once you've got some sparks in air that's full of microwaves, apparently getting plasma is just kind of the next step. So, yeah, I'm now like all about fruit in the microwave.
No, it is great. I didn't even know it was plasma. I just knew it was this great thing that happened. It doesn't happen every time for me. It happens a lot of times for me. But so other than understanding what the reaction is there some implication or applicability of that principle to some larger science thing?
Yeah, there may be applications to it. They're still trying to figure out. That's kind of their next step, is figuring out why it happens sometimes and why it doesn't and working this out more. But, I mean, the story of how this even came about as a scientific paper, actually in a leading journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, is fabulous, because it's this researcher who mostly works on microscopy and optics in this totally different field, had some undergrads who came in, and they didn't really have space and time for them to be doing some of this laser and microscope research that they typically do. So kind of said, you know, here's the microwave.
I love this.
And they spent a few years. They've had multiple undergrads work on this. They submitted it to like four different journals, who totally dismissed them before they got taken seriously in explaining this phenomenon and how it works and what the ramifications of it might be. So, yeah, it's just such a fun science story.
So is it fair to say I'm sort of like a science pioneer is what you're
like
saying?
Pioneer
savant. You are way ahead of the curve.
Hey, Heather, I'm so glad you got turned on. It is so much fun. People should
should try it at home, unlike
get
other
some
things.
Grapes immediately.
Or an olive, or what else did you say? Blueberries?
Blueberries, cherries, any small fruit about that size.
Fabulous. Good to talk to you, Heather.
All
thanks
right,
for your time.
Sorry about that mess up. Heather Gosone joins us regularly. She's an expert in ocean science and the host of Living Lab Radio, which you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 WGBH, Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on WCAI 90.1. Coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you, now that we see what cheating your way into college looks like, are people finally going to stop making students of color feel like frauds? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. A college entrance scheme revealed that many uber-rich parents shell out big bucks for their kids' fraudulent admission, faking more than just test scores. One wealthy Massachusetts parent, Marjorie's going to describe the story, was in the Globe today, which is unbelievable, used bribes to elevate his son from a just-okay water polo player to the future star of the USC team, I shouldn't laugh, an even faster swimmer than the members of the elite squad. The catch was, of course, he wasn't. His talent was a lie. You know, the other day we talked about this, and our theme was sort of, where does this leave the kid who did swim faster and didn't make the cut? But the thing that was prompted by, what's Vargas's first name, the story in the Washington
Post?
Teresa Vargas's fabulous, fabulous piece in today's Washington Post is, does this mean those who have blamed poor kids of color for taking the spots of, quote, more deserving white kids, you know, those who rail against affirmative action, will finally shut up? And I hope that is one of the few positives that comes out of that. Her piece is brilliant. We'll describe it to you a little bit if you haven't read it. We talked to Andrew Cabral about it. But our number is 877-301-8970. And do you not think this Vargas woman has a wonderful point? That's who so many people have looked at. Well, why is that kid of color there? And, you know, she's a poor kid and all this sort of stuff. And we were never looking at the kid of a wealthy white family and asking the same sorts of questions. And if you want to be fair and you want to ask questions after this remarkable broad indictment announced by Andrew Lulling, the U.S. attorney from Massachusetts, I think on Monday, I think you have to ask those questions either first or at the same time. The number is 877-301-8970. Can you describe this Wilson thing a little bit?
Well, his name is John B. Wilson. He's a 59-year-old investor, homes in Hyannisport and Linfield, founded something called Hyannisport Capital, a real estate and private equity firm. And he worked at Bain and Company and Staples and Gap. Anyway, back in 2014, he paid this singer guy who was arranging all this sham stuff $220,000 to get his son into USC, as you just said, Jim, as a supposed fantastic water polo player. This kid could fly, supposedly what the coach who got paid claimed about him. And then last year, when this singer was already cooperating with officials and his phones were being tapped, he was ready to pay $1 million to try to secure spots for his daughters at Stanford and Harvard. And he was very excited because when he did make the payment to this singer character, he said he would make the payments, list them as a consulting fee so he could deduct those payments from his taxes.
Or charge it to his consulting business so he didn't have to pay them at all. This is so corrupt and so grotesque. And if you want to talk about the underlying indictments, it is perfectly fine. Chuck Todd was ready to explode today over this whole thing and what it says about the whole college admission system. That's fine. But I think the point that was made that I'm embarrassed I didn't make before having read this Teresa Vargas's piece in the Washington Post,
yep,
is that it should mean an end to these stupid, vicious questions that too many people have asked about the kid of color who some white kid thinks doesn't deserve a place
in his or her school.
Well, she said she talked about how she went to Stanford as an undergraduate, and then she went to Columbia University, the journalism school.
This is Vargas.
This is Vargas, and she talks about how she felt the need to prove herself over and over again, that she actually earned her spot, that she was not some token, that she had, you know, she'd be defending her SAT scores, her perfect GPA record, the resume she had when she applied to Stanford, because there was this assumption that she just got in there because she was a lesser kid in terms of her brains, and she got there because she was an affirmative action kid that didn't deserve to be there. And she talked about how this woman, Liz Dwyer, I think this is a tweet, I'm not sure what this is, but this woman that was at Northwestern, a woman of color, she said, quote, "One of my teachers held a class discussion about why I get into Northwestern and some of my white classmates didn't. They decided it was because I was black. Never mind that I had a 3.8 GPA and took all honors AP classes, crushed the SAT, and that teacher told those kids I stole their spot." I mean, it's unbelievable. I must admit, I have heard this over and over again. You know, when your kids are at a very competitive high school and everybody wants to go to Harvard and they're all edging out, you know, taking all these summer internships in foreign countries and stuff so they can look like they build schoolhouses for poor people and all these things and taking all these extra courses. I think this might change things a little bit. I'm not sure, but I think it might change things.
By the way, there's a lawsuit. CNN's reporting two Stanford students are filing this class action lawsuit, basically saying they contend they may have been denied admission at places like Yale. They did obviously get into Stanford because there were unqualified people who got in,
yep,
but only got in through this corrupt, this criminal activity Lelling was describing on Monday.
Wilson said, by the way, that his son was unaware of the arrangement, but it's a weird thing because you would get there and you would have to go to team events and you would have to work out with the team. Now, he left the water polo team after the first semester, but you wonder what the kid thought. I remember when I went to Stanford a million years ago, it was full of all these Olympians. So they were all going to the Olympics.
The best swimmers in the country, aren't they?
Yeah. And, you know, I can swim fine, but you almost were embarrassed to go to the pool because people were doing triple flips off the high diving board, and you thought, my goodness, you know, your little side stroke wasn't going to cut it in the pool at Stanford
I can tread
University.
Water for an hour. By the way, as I said earlier to Andrew Cabral, Andy Borowitz is our favorite satirist, Marjorie's and mine in the country. He writes this piece, Betsy DeVos suggests that bribing colleges helps students learn math. That's the upside. So here are just two paragraphs in this. Let's say it'll cost Amber $75,000 to get into Stanford. It'll cost her twin brother, Dylan, $75,000 to get into Georgetown. How much money will total where her parents have to wire to the guy in California? But the better one is, or let's say Jenna has a 470 verbal score in her SAT, but she needs a 730 to get into Yale, DeVos said. How much will she have to pay to get her score changed? 877-301-8970. Kevin, you're in calling from Florida. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Shouldn't the parents of these privileged children who paid big money into Singer's not-for-profit be liable for tax fraud in addition to all the other offenses they committed?
Well, I don't know that part of the charges, and in some cases guilty pleas, were not for tax fraud. I mean, I assume that's based on what Marjorie just read from the Wilson thing. If it's a personal expense and it's cooked so that it's a charitable contribution, when in fact there's no charitable purpose, or written off as a business expense, then
here's,
have a point.
Here's the email between Wilson and Singer. Wilson is the guy from Hyannisport in Linfield. He said, please give me the invoice. What are the options for the payment? Can we make it for consulting or whatever so that I can pay it from the corporate account? And apparently Singer told Wilson he could list the payments as a consulting fee so he could deduct them from his taxes as a business expense.
So again,
awesome, Wilson replied.
Awesome is what he said, right? We don't know if that is in the indictments, Kevin, but I would say it's pretty obvious that if it isn't, can be. Thanks for the call. And by the way, people are speculating, if you read a lot of the comments about this, that there are many more indictments to come based upon the number of incidents that have been reported. We shall see.
And, you know, for the children that had no idea this was going on,
By their parents, I mean.
How devastating. Humiliating.
Well, you would hope. You would hope. Well, except we played the sound yesterday from the Laura Loughlin's kid who sound. Didn't she say, I don't really care what I learned. I just want to know how good the parties are, whatever the hell she said in that little pathetic video. Beverly and Rainham, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two things. Marjorie just brought up. One of my points I was going to make is about the children who didn't know their parents were doing this, mm-hmm. and now they're stuck in a situation they're not ready for. Right. I think that the whole thing is an ego trip for the parents to say they've got kids in these fancy schools. They have not thought about their children, that they're detrimental to the children who aren't ready. They've set them up to fail.
Yeah, Beverly, thank you for the call. That's a good point. I mean, I think it is. And for the kids that didn't know, apparently they're looking into there is some suspicion that some of them did know, but they haven't indicted any of the children because they're the prime movers here, the parents, as they said, and this guy Singer that ran this company. But let's stick to our discussion, though. I mean, if you had kids that just come through high school recently, I mean, there is that really nasty trope you hear over and over again that, well, you know, if so-and-so's a black kid, she got in because she was a black kid. You know, she beat my kid out. My kid was smarter and had better grades, but she beat her out because...
And were it not for affirmative action,
yes,
my kid would have gone to that school.
Yes, and I think what you see is that the real affirmative action is the other end.
Exactly right.
The really, really wealthy kids. And that's not to mention the fact that really wealthy kids, without breaking the law, can also take advantage of all these extra prep courses and have people help them write their essay and have extra help with everything. So there's already that disparity.
Well, you know,
there.
That's why we've discussed this before. Will this lead to some reform, some of the legal ways, like you just described, that wealthier families are able to help their kids get into better schools, again, which are perfectly legal and arguably ethical, even though there's some ethics question when a poor kid can't afford it, will this cause policymakers, governors, legislators to decide the same question you were asking the other day? Are schools – who was the guy, the teacher who called us yesterday?
Yeah.
I can't remember what city he called from. And was it Beverly, I think? And you asked them if they provided
yes.
courses for free in the high school
test preparation. He said
they did. Test preparation
which
in
is
that
great.
Community, they did.
And they should. I don't know many high schools
to level
that do
the playing
that,
field.
But if that's a great thing because everybody should have access to those tests because it does make a big difference. And that's one of the reasons kids go up from the PSATs to their SATs because they study between mm-hmm. the time they take the PSATs and the SATs. Penny in Weymouth. Oops. We lost
you. Our apologies if that's our fault. 877-301-8970.
Margaret in Dover. Hi, Margaret.
Hello, Margaret.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Good.
So I had the opportunity to work at an all-boys elite private school outside of Boston. I won't say the name. It's a boarding school. You can guess it yourself.
Yes.
when you work in development, you get to see a whole different view of what it's like. So, you know, if you want that building named after your name, your kid gets in, and onward and onward. And not only the buildings, but I saw many people with very big names that I would never say on the radio get their kids into schools that were average schools. I mean, average private schools, in my opinion. They would pay $35,000, $50,000 in a gift to get their child into that school before they left the school I worked at.
But
they would give a gift of that much just to get their kid in.
But, Margaret, you know, somebody called us yesterday or on whatever day Lelling made this announcement earlier this week and said schools need money. So if Charles Kushner gives $2.5 million to Harvard, even though Harvard's a bad example since their endowment is almost, I think it's in the neighborhood of $40 billion, but a lesser school that could use the $35,000 you described in a private school or the college that could use the $100,000, I assume the understanding, I'm not defending this, I'm just stating it, is, and if I give you the $100,000 or if I give your academy the $35,000, my kid's going to get in, and the person who leads the place says, I need that money, and I'll be able to use that money to make this place maybe more available to low-income kids, and hopefully that's not just a scam. How do you respond to that? They need money. It's being offered. There's a quid pro quo, which is not illegal, I guess. How do you respond to that?
I am not of the lower income bracket, but my daughter is incredibly brilliant, and she did not get into the Boston private well-known school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say it.
Yeah.
Because they took somebody else who was and had a legacy and had more money,
mm-hmm.
and that person never went through the year. They hated it. They took my daughter. She then made it on the front of their annual magazine as a, and I've called here before, so I'm not going to say it, but as a successful Michelin star chef. They didn't take her because the money wasn't there, but they took her finally, you know, after she had gone to Ursuline Academy, to be honest with you, and she'd outgrown it, you know, artistically, athletically, academically, and you know, then they took her in because that person that was there for the money decided, well, I don't want to go there anymore.
Margaret, so thank you. We appreciate your sharing the story with us. Yeah, I'm very anxious to talk to Paul Revel and some other people in the education and people like Governor Baker is going to be with us, I think, on the 21st and others. But what happens as a result of this? What kind of reform is there? I mean, obviously, they're going to work hard to ensure that they're not criminal activity. I'm not as concerned about the criminal activity. I hope it's not as widespread as it could be. I'm talking about the legal activity that creates inequities that this has shown a light on that that I guess people knew about but didn't focus much on.
I mean, I don't know that if you're Jared Kushner's parents and you want to pay $2.6 million to get Jared into Harvard, and that's not illegal. I mean, they're making that donation.
As far as I know, it's not, yeah.
I don't know that they're going to stop that because, as Chuck Todd said before, these colleges are largely dependent on donations.
Was it Chuck who said that? Yeah.
Yeah, it was Chuck who said that, and I thought that was a great point.
So we're going to talk about this more in the weeks, days and weeks ahead because it seems to matter to a lot of people, as it should.
So thank you for listening today, and you can keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast, our Boston Public Radio podcast. Tomorrow, stop by the library for the neighborhood or listen to us on air, of course, 11 to 7. Our Friday All-Stars, Callie Crossley, Emily Rooney, and Shirley Young will be there, as well as the stars of Romeo and Juliet. Want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker. What's on TV, Jim?
Well, you know, we were going to discuss the thing we discussed on the radio the other day, the whole question of old candidates for president and the wonderful story that was in the Ideas section of the Globe on Sunday. And we decided that it was an even better topic than it was yesterday because a young guy, a 46-year-old, is in the race, Beto O'Rourke. And will that cause there to be even more focus on the age of the front runners? And should there be? We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about, you'll like this, by the way, the unelection and reelection of the mayor of your hometown Fall River with Frank Phillips from the Globe, obviously the former head of the State House Bureau, Joanna Weiss, now at Northeastern, formerly of the Globe, and Michael Curry, head of the NAACP. And by the way, the NAACP convention is coming here in 2020, and I wonder what role Michael Curry, he was former head of the Boston NAACP, is now on the national board. We're doing that and some other things as well. That's 7 o'clock tonight.
Fantastic. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in.
Thanks.
Please tune again tomorrow or visit us at the library. Have a great afternoon.